all new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at one, it's Richard Spur, but next here on LBC, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We will hear about the push to get us off our addiction to fossil fuels by Energy Minister Ed Miliband, as the precariousness of that addiction is highlighted by the Iran war. They're growing meat in laboratories, and it could be on our supermarket shelves soon. We'll get the story about that. Meta, Facebook's owner, and Google, the owner of YouTube, are being sued in California over how addictive their social media feeds are. We'll hear about that. It's Oscars night. We'll get an update from Hollywood and check in with our US correspondent for the other news from there. But first, the US and UK view of the war in Iran so far. That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. The University of Kent has confirmed a student is one of the two people who've died following a meningitis outbreak in Canterbury. The UK Health Security Agency is now investigating, while the institution says it's working closely with public health teams. More now from LBC's Joe Hawkins.
According to the agency, it was notified of 13 cases showing signs and symptoms of meningitis and septicemia between Friday and today. Its specific strain hasn't been identified. At the moment, the UK Health Security Agency says both it and the University of Kent are issuing advice to staff and students. Agency specialists are also interviewing affected individuals and their families to help identify all close contacts and arrange the distribution of antibiotics.
A 43-year-old woman is due in court tomorrow, charged with the murder of an 18-day-old baby. She was arrested after the body of an infant was found at Westminster in central London on Saturday. Police were responding to reports it had fallen from a height. Iranian state media has told residents in specific areas of Dubai and Doha to evacuate after claiming US military personnel are hiding there. It's warning Tehran may target those areas in the coming hours. 12 arrests have been made in London during two protests connected to the Middle East. Police used the River Thames to separate the demonstration, called to mark Al-Quds Day and an opposing event. LBC's Liam Gotting was there.
The Met Police say multiple arrests were made over the course of the day and they are investigating chants made at the Al-Quds protest. Earlier in the week, the Home Secretary banned the march following a request from the Met Police Commissioner Sir Mark Rowley because of a real risk of serious violence and disorder. And while there were a handful of minor clashes between police and protesters, largely it played out peacefully on both sides of the protest.
Two men have been placed under investigation in France on the suspicion of planning a deadly anti-Semitic attack. Prosecutors say they're 22 and 20 and were detained during a roadside check by police. A semi-automatic gun, acid and a flag linked to so-called Islamic State were recovered. And detectives trying to identify the body of a man found inside a wheelie bin in Coventry say he had a series of distinctive tattoos on his back and right arm. He was discovered at Cashers Park on Friday. It's thought he was aged between 40 and 50. LBC weather, blustery showers overnight, particularly in the northwest. They could be wintry across northern hills as well. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. It has been reported that countries, including this one, and Japan, China and South Korea have said that they're still considering their options, but have not made commitments after Donald Trump urged them to send warships to the Strait of Hormuz to secure that vital shipping route. Meanwhile, the Iranian foreign minister said that Tehran sees no reason to negotiate with the United States of America and will continue for fighting, fighting for as long as it takes. Daniel L. Davis is a former lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, a senior fellow for defense priorities, and host of Daniel Davis Deep Dive on YouTube, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Thanks for your time. Is this what Trump ran on? Is this America first?
Yeah, this is as close as you can get to the literal polar opposite of America First. This is America None, and even more so, I mean, more to the point, is he ran on no more stupid wars. He ran on ending the ones that were going on. He hasn't done that. And now here he has started one, and really for the second time. And, of course, you can even add the Venezuela operation on top of that, the Caribbean boat. I mean, the list just keeps going on and on. Of course, this is by far the worst and the most costliest. And unlike these others, you can't just dabble around and play and throw a few missiles out there and then just walk away and say you're done and claim victory. This time we have plunged ourselves into something that has no observable off-ramp. And now then, because for the first time in my living history, you have an opponent of the United States that said, hey, we're going to stand up to you no matter what it costs us, however many missiles you want to throw at us, how many troops, we're going to fight until you succumb to our terms. No one's ever done that to us, much less Donald Trump, and he doesn't know how to get out of it. And frankly, I don't see any easy off-ramps that he can take, period.
Trump said that Iran's nuclear program has been completely obliterated, and then he said that it hadn't. He said that the war was over, and then that it wasn't. That he only will accept total surrender, and then he said that's not what he is looking for, and that he wouldn't put boots on the ground, and now he will, and that he was ready to talk, and now that he isn't. Do you think there's any plan to any of this, or are they just winging it?
I mean, how can it be any way besides it's just being winged? I mean, you can see that in the words, but you can also see that in the actions, given that we just sent a Marine unit, an MEU, it toward the Gulf today, or yesterday, I guess it finally set sail, and it's steaming there with its escorts as fast as it can get there. But that tells you that there was no thought given to the thought we might need that ahead of time. And you can even go back into the January 13th, 14th, when it looked like this was about to start then. Then all of a sudden it went into, okay, well, let's have more diplomacy. And then they send a second aircraft carrier strike group, the Gerald R. Ford. And so it's like you have not thought this through at all, and you keep saying, oh, well, we need more, so throw this out there. And then now that here it didn't work out, your plan A, which was a wing and a prayer, hoping that an assassination on the Ayatollah would cause the collapse of their government. When that didn't happen, we had no resourced plan to figure it out after that. If Iran stood their ground and fought, we didn't have the resources to compel them to do it. And now you're seeing that play out. So now then we're getting desperate. Now we're even thinking about any kind of a boots on the ground operation, whether that's seizing an island, having some kind of shoreline operation to I don't even know what they would do, push further inland. I don't know what the value would be of that. But those things apparently are on the table, and they would all add to a disaster that is already almost unparalleled in my lifetime.
What kind of adversary is Iran militarily compared to, say, Iraq or Afghanistan?
Well, they've always been a significant difference than those others in that they have a very powerful missile force, and they have the ability to defend their shores, which none of those others did. That's why it was always an easy target, all the way going back to 2001 in Afghanistan or 2003 in Iraq or 1991 in Iraq, for that matter. They had a very, very poor conventional military. They didn't have a missile force. They didn't have a drone force. And, of course, that's the biggest difference here, is that Iran has learned a great deal from the Russia-Ukraine war, both in terms of the naval operations, where the Ukrainian side, with basically without a navy, pushed the Russian Black Sea Fleet all the way back out of Sevastopol, etc., in part because of anti-ship cruise missiles and drone boats. And now then Iran has both of those categories of weapons, and they have underwater, they call them underwater missiles. It's like a modern torpedo that can go much faster and maneuver underwater. All those now are coming to play. If we don't attack, however, those things stay in their sheath because they're not offensive weapons. They can't attack anybody, and they showed they had no interest in closing the strait unless we went in there with a war of choice, which is where we are now.
Yeah, and Pete Hegseth said he got very irate with journalists and the headlines that they were writing that the war wasn't going tremendously well. And he said that America was not surprised by the Iranian attacks in the Strait of Hormuz, but they didn't have any Navy ships there, and I still don't, as far as I'm aware, to escort tankers through. I mean, does that make any sense?
No, it doesn't. And that's somebody who's caught in a lie, and they're doing everything they can using their position and authority to try and compel and coerce others into having the narrative that they want. I watched that exchange, and I found it reprehensible, because he's talking about stuff like, why don't you talk about how hard it is for our crew members, how difficult it is to do aerial refueling, how brave they're fighting. No one's questioning that. That's not even on the table. Everybody knows that there's the professionalism of our troops is unquestioned. What is very much in question is the orders that they're given by the senior leaders, i.e. the Secretary of War. That is a big question. I just told you just a couple things right off the top, that the plans were clearly not resourced. You definitely did not expect them to do what they have done, or you would have had a lot more assets there. And in fact, you would have taken action at the beginning to try and forestall some of these capabilities, which we didn't. So instead of yelling at the reporters in a press room, he needs to be looking in a mirror and saying those statements.
More generally, what do you make of the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth's competency and fitness for the job?
I mean, just based on performance, it's woefully inadequate. And I'll admit, when his name was first brought up, I said, let's give him a chance, because maybe what we need is somebody from the outside that's not just a standard old, you know, fogey who's, you know, been in defense industry and has, you know, been a four-star general or whatever. Maybe we need new thinking, because he had two combat deployments. He had two Bronze Star medals. That's bravery under fire. So I said, maybe he's what we need. Let's give him a shot. And didn't turn out that way, because now he's as bad as I think that the previous ones were, like Lloyd Austin, et cetera. I thought they were awful in terms of job of an actual Secretary of Defense. But he has shown that he is much worse, because he doesn't understand how combat works. And he's given these orders with a lot of confidence, and they're grossly inadequate or insufficient. And he doesn't seem to be aware of just how bad his policies are.
How's it going down with the rest of the military? Because the first introduction that most of them had to him was being called from all four corners of the earth to sit in an audience while he harangued them for their lack of physical fitness and their inappropriate facial hair.
Right. Yeah, that did not go over well at the time, and you can be sure it's even more gritty now. There's a lot of people who are very dissatisfied. I don't have a whole lot of contacts on the active force anymore. I retired in 2015, but those that I do have, they're just, you know, beside themselves of thinking, how did this guy get in charge of us? And, you know, we have to obey his orders, you know, and that also led to the issue of some Democratic members of the House and Senate, you know, telling troops and doing this video that you don't have to obey illawful or illegal orders, etc. So it's just caused lots of division. But I'll just tell you, I mean, unless he does give a flat-out unlawful order, even if it's a stupid order, our troops are going to execute it because they're professionals. But, man, they should not be put into position to try and execute orders that only can fail. That's my worry.
Is it reasonable to expect somebody in the military to actually refuse an order that a legal scholar might later consider to be illegal?
I will say it's almost impossible. I can't even. I've put myself in their position, and would I do it? Because, you know, they have said over and over, oh, well, we've run it through our legal department, and they have said it's legal. So for you to say, well, I know more than a lawyer does, and I think it's illegal, so I'm not going to obey it. I mean, you're setting yourself up to go to the brig and maybe stay in jail for a long time, because, you know, a court of law that's going to be run by some of these same people is probably not going to be very forgiving to you. So it would have to be something like in the My Lai situation in the Vietnam War, where someone says, here, go and shoot all these unarmed civilians, then you might get something. But some of these that are in the nebulous area or in the gray area, I can't even imagine anybody on the force right now saying no to that.
And he's already saying it out loud. Pete Hegseth said that no quarter should be given to the Iranians, which means not accepting troops surrendering. He said maximum lethality, not tepid legality. I mean, it sounds like he's encouraging war crimes.
Well, it does. And then you can add to that, he also says, you know, no more weak rules of engagement, which, of course, is critically important to have effective rules of engagement. And he said, yeah, none of that either. No mercy, he added to the same list of potential war crimes, setting aside up. Because here's the thing, even if people execute those and do them, I mean, they're going to be held accountable, because everybody's accountable for their own actions ultimately, but he would be accountable above all for saying that. So if anybody acts on his word, He's the one that's going to jail. And I think he's already putting himself into enormous legal difficulties, even if nothing happens in the future. But my worry is that there are those in the service that may say, well, I've got cover from the top, so I'm not going to give any mercy. I am going to be merciless, no quarter given, et cetera. So it's a very, very dangerous situation and bad for the United States.
And what about the very top? Because Trump has apparently spent the weekend golfing and picking fights with television talk show hosts and telling people that he can understand Spanish while not being able to speak that language. I mean, does any of that give you cause for concern?
Well, all of it gives me cause for concern. I mean, two of his Truth Social posts over the weekend where he said that Iran is 100% decimated. All of their military capacity is out. He's calling for them to just surrender, lay down their arms, which, of course, there's no possibility of that, and then to call for the navies of the UK after he just mocked them ruthlessly on, I think, the 6th of March and said, yeah, I don't care about you now after the war's already been won. And now he's saying, hey, how about your navy? And then adding China into that same mix, that somebody who's obviously an ally of sorts with Iran, like they're going to come in and force the thing open. It's all very disturbing activity. I can just tell you, I do have a lot of worries about it.
Do you think that Trump and the people around him have any idea what winning would actually look like?
No, they don't, because they literally gambled everything on basically a coup d'etat, to where you would come in on the opening rounds, you had a shock and awe type opening rounds, you assassinate the supreme leader, and you think you're going to win, because that's kind of what happened with the Maduro situation. They had this big splashy, basically 2-hour military operation in Caracas, and lots of good video for television. They grabbed the leader, no casualties, killed about 80 people, something like that, but who cares about them, right? I mean, they're not Americans. We didn't even care about their lives, but none of ours got lost. And I think that they got high on that, thinking that, well, we can do that everywhere. We're never wrong. Trump said that afterwards. He said, all my decisions have been proven right, which is an incredibly dangerous, arrogant position to think that what happened in Venezuela is going to be even closely, even at all related to what might happen in Iran for about 20 different reasons. But that seems to be the case. And then when that didn't materialize, now here you're in a war and you have no obvious off ramps, and they literally don't know what to do, because Iran is doing something that nobody has ever done, and I didn't think they thought that would be done. They thought that with enough pain they'll finally submit and give in, but now then it's clear that they're going to say, bring all your pain, we're ready for it, and it's not going to be enough, but can you deal with our pain? And that's what is different, and they don't have an answer for that. I don't know that there is an answer, short of acknowledging some of the terms that the Iranians are asking for, which are anathema to us surrendering. And that's why I fear that my biggest fear is not that we will just keep fighting on endlessly, but that we'll risk escalating either with an insanely foolish attempt to have a ground invasion, or possibly worse, use tactical nuclear weapons as, you know, a cheap, easy way to bring them to their knees, like the Japanese in World War II. I've already heard some people contemplate on the possibility of that, and I consider it very concerning.
Wow. Well, that's the first time I've heard anybody say that. That's I'll give you a pause for thought. Are there any examples, excuse me, are there any examples of a change in an entrenched regime by air raid alone?
No. And in fact, on my show, the Daniel Davis Deep Dive this past week, I had Dr. Robert Pape of Chicago on, who is a historian and has covered this kind of war, especially the Middle East, for at least 2 decades that he's been writing, that I've been following his work. And he said in his research, in the last 100 years of the modern era, he can't think of a single time when a country was able to be brought to its knees by air power alone. The only one that's come close is the Kosovo situation in, I think, 1997 or 98, whenever that was, and after 78 days of bombing, Milosevic gave in to some of the demands that we had. But an actual surrender, I've never seen one, and neither has Dr. Pape.
Do you think that the Iranians actually appear to have been more prepared for all of this than the Americans were?
Oh, without question. That's not even a question. It's 100% certain. They have been literally preparing for decades for this, because they've expected eventually this would happen. And so you've seen these elaborate underground facilities, missile cities, some are calling them, for good reason, because they're incredibly complex. And they've obviously spent many, many years building each one of them, spreading them out, giving them protection, et cetera. And then even according to some folks I've seen since the 2012, I'm sorry, the 2025-12 day war, they updated their plans, recognized a lot of their errors and mistakes and mistakes in planning and assumptions, et cetera, updated those, made even more preparations. And that primarily means updating the amount of weapons they have, the logistics and supplies underground so that they could sustain something long, because they knew that if it came in, there would be enormous amounts of power against them. And that's certainly what has happened. But now that it appears that they were prepared well ahead of time to endure this kind of bombardment and it draw this thing out for many, many, many months, possibly even a year or two.
And what do you
and
make?
We can't.
And what do you make of Russia supplying Iran with targeting intelligence at least, and possibly with weaponry at most, while the president of the United States is actually essentially handing Vladimir Putin hundreds of millions of dollars by unbanning their oil?
Well, and that's part of the damned if you do, damned if you don't situation President Trump put himself in, because with the Strait shut down and, you know, 19 million barrels a day being basically shut off the global market, it's got to be replaced somewhere. And strategic reserves are being released in countries all over the country, but the world, but it's not enough to offset that. So he's got to say, I need more oil on the market. And the only one there is Russia to do that. So he's like, hey, we'll, you know, pull the stoppers off of you. And so you can sell more oil because that helps us, because that keeps prices down for the West. It limits it. It doesn't even keep it from, I mean, it's already from 67 to basically 100. We'll see where it is in the morning, but, it's almost certainly going to keep going up. So he's trying to mitigate the damage, but that's only because we got into this situation in the beginning. I mean, that's the core of the problem.
And just finally, as a military man, what did you make of the rock videos of explosions cut with sports clips and set to the music of AC/DC that the White House is posting while American service personnel are coming back in coffins?
Yeah, it was as shameful as anything that I have seen in my adult lifetime, any time, even looking back in history. I've never seen in the history of our country the presidential administration doing something so childish as doing those. I mean, if I can just be blunt, it wasn't even good media. It wasn't even good art. It was very poor quality and even more poor taste. And I just wonder, what is the mentality of somebody that thinks that's a good idea? Who do they think that's going to appeal to? How is that going to help the war effort? How is that going to help American support of this when the gasoline prices are going up, the price of everything else commensurate, therefore groceries, rent, everything else is going up, and somehow they think that's going to make people support the war anyway? I truly don't understand what the thought is behind it, but it's very embarrassing and shameful.
Good to have your thoughts on that. Thanks so much for your time, Daniel. That's Daniel L. Davis, former Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army, Senior Fellow for Defense Priorities, and host of Daniel Davis Deep Dive on YouTube. We're going to get the British perspective after the news at 5:30, but I'd be interested in your thoughts about what you've just heard and what you've been seeing on your TV and hearing on your radio over the last couple of weeks or so. 0345 6060 973. LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
This is a shameful, this is a shambles.
Straight to the point.
How was that allowed to happen?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Show some evidence, Minister.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Tuesday night on the sofa, watching telly with Mum. Again.
Male orcas stay with the mothers for life.
This is the moment Stephen chose to speak to Barclays about Mortgage Boost, so he could borrow more with help from family or friends. We're helping first-time buyers get on the property ladder sooner. Search Barclays Mortgages. Barclays. Backing your future.
Your home may be repossessed if you do not keep up repayments on your mortgage. Subject to application, financial circumstances and borrowing history. T's and C's apply.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low, slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curve leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. They will affect how you manage your tenancies. Act now. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So we're going to get the view of a British military person after the news at 10:30, but I'm interested in your thoughts about what you just heard and the things that you've been seeing on telly and hearing on the radio about all of this, and what you think perhaps our interaction with it should be. Do you think we should be as far away as possible, or are we essentially in it now, so we'd better work hard for for the benefit of the nation? Goring by sea. Hello, Ash.
Hi, Nick. Hope you're well.
Yeah, good, thanks.
I think we should be steering well clear at the moment. I think that Starmer's handled it brilliantly. I think the British people seem to mostly be on his side. But I think he's handling our best interest at the moment, not the interests of our allies. We should be thinking of our interests in this situation.
But are our interests sort of tied up with the price of oil, which is inevitably going to go up, and it will continue to go up for as long as this conflagration continues? So is it not in our interest to bring it to a close as soon as possible? And by that method, it would mean actually getting involved.
It would, wouldn't it? I mean, I think that we're already involved to an extent that our base was now used, wasn't it, in the end? I think he said yes. But I think that, well, just from my perspective, I think that paying higher prices for fuel at the moment is perhaps worth it, because we have a president who says that the conflict's going to be over one minute. He changes his mind the next minute. And I pointed out that here, this war secretary that they have, I think it was, I don't remember what it was called before then, but they renamed it, didn't they? He was on stage the other day saying that he only wants to speak American. We've got two clowns behind
it. Did he say that?
And it's concerning.
I only want to speak American. Is that what he said?
Yeah, he said to his the small guy. What's his name? Mark Rubio.
Marco.
He
yeah.
was speaking. That's it. He was speaking Spanish to some of the speakers in the audience, and Hegseth said that he only wants to speak American. You sort of slap your face, don't you?
Well, it would be more funny if it wasn't so serious, but it is a little funny. Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, Ash. Cheers. 0345 6060973. Do you think we're actually being dragged into this, whether we like it or not? Because it is already affecting us. You've seen the price of the petrol, and that's quite possibly just the beginning of it. And with the price of petrol and diesel, there shortly after comes the price rise in, well, absolutely everything. Everything is delivered to a shop by road. And almost all of the vehicles that go to those stores are powered by petrol and diesel. And further back up the chain, you know, we've got the price of fertilizer, which has gone through the roof, so the price of food, and there could be food gaps on the shelves in supermarkets. So it does feel a bit as though we're being we've been cornered, and we're being forced, perhaps against our wishes, to get involved in a war that is being conducted by somebody who doesn't appear to know what it's for. Would you get on a bus that says they're going to a destination, but they're not going to tell you where it is? Probably not. Would you join a war if you didn't know what the purpose of it was? If the person who is conducting the war had no idea what winning the war would actually look like. Aylesford. Hello, Tony.
Hello, Nick. First of all, I need to ask you a question. This is definitely it is the serious show, not the unserious show, yeah?
Sunday, yes.
Yes, I know. I don't think we should get involved. I said to you last week, we should not get involved, and Keir Starmer shouldn't be manipulated by Donald Trump. And I just think, from what I've heard in the last 24 hours, that we may get involved, but I just don't think we should. I've noticed the petrol prices myself, they're going up, but I just think we should stay out of it. And that's my opinion, and I am a bit disappointed if Keir Starmer does.
Yes, well, apparently the president said that, it was not apparently, he did. He said that he didn't need our help. He didn't need the help of a country that was going to join in after the war had already been won. So,
which it hasn't been.
It's alarming that a man who is leading the war would say that the war has been won, and then in pretty much the next breath, ask for our help in winning the war. So, I would say it's you would join in with trepidation, and that seems to be the way in which the countries that Trump has called upon are behaving. He's called on us, China, France, Japan, South Korea, and the response has been, it's reported to have been muted.
Yeah, but I think Keir Starmer's playing a blinder. I think he's saying, with this shit, I don't think he wanted to send that. I think there's a bit of this and that going on, we're not going to send it yet. I think he may not get too involved. And there was something else I just wanted to say, but I completely forgot now. I don't think he will get too involved. I really don't. But I was doing a game in the week, and then they were going, this would be it. The referees, who are a Trump fan, they were saying, that'd be over in a week. And I went, you stupid. It's not going to be over anytime soon. He's caused an absolute international catastrophe for everyone. And I do think it's going to be the end of Trump soon, hopefully.
All right, well, we'll see. Thanks a lot, Tony. 0345-6060-973. After the news, the United Kingdom, our once great ally, maybe the greatest of them all, is finally giving serious thought to sending two aircraft carriers to the Middle East. That's okay, Prime Minister Starmer. We don't need them any longer. That was Donald Trump. Things change. We speak with a retired Air Vice Marshal on the hypocrisy coming from Donald Trump's White House next. It's 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The University of Kent has confirmed a student is one of the two people to have died following a meningitis outbreak in Canterbury. The UK Health Security Agency is investigating. The institution says it's working closely with public health teams. Downing Street says the Prime Minister will respond to the Middle East situation tomorrow by promising to protect working people from the challenges ahead. It's also expected he will detail plans to help those using increasingly expensive heating oil to keep their homes warm. And a 43-year-old woman is due in court tomorrow, charged with the murder of an 18-day-old baby. She was arrested after the body of an infant was found at Westminster in central London on Saturday. LBC weather, blustery showers overnight, particularly in the northwest. They could be heavy at times and they could be wintry over northern hills. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees.
LBC.
Everything dinner at Ocado. Save on sausages, tinned tomatoes, and get a great price on garlic. Then splurge on the fancy pasta. The kind you know you're pronouncing wrong, which means it must be good. Save and splurge at Ocado, the online supermarket. Select lines only, geographical restrictions, minimum spend and charges apply. Offers end 24th of March. Terms and offer info at ocado.com/terms.
If you were missold a home on a holiday park, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900.
Hi, I'm Sava, founder of Cool You. And when it comes to getting aircon into London's hot and stuffy apartments and listed buildings, I'm the daddy. For years, Cool You have supplied and installed fully internal aircon systems with no mess, no fuss, and no external condensers. So head to coolyou.london today. Cool You for a cool, comfortable home.
My name is Beverly, and this is my NHS story. I had to make regular journeys to my local CDC for blood tests because I had lymphoma. I think it really helps to know that you've got somewhere local. It was really a godsend.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Yes, I'm interested in your thoughts about the scale of the operation that we should be engaged in the war in Iran, whether we should be steaming over there straight away or trying to stay as far away as possible. 0345 6060973. Sean Bell is a former fighter pilot, now military analyst and co-host of the Red Matrix podcast, and he is on the line joining us now. Hello, Sean.
Good evening, Nick.
And Trump said that he didn't need our help, and now he says that he does. What changed, do you think?
Well, I'd have been fascinated to be a fly on the wall when you had that Keir Starmer Trump call, because, as you say, Trump has said he didn't need our help. He derided our Prime Minister for not allowing to use Fairford and Diego Garcia, that he didn't need the Prince of Wales, and he's also been getting his foot off the throat of Putin with the oil sanctions. And then all of a sudden he makes a call and says, right, we need help. I think what's happening here is Trump clearly has demonstrated that he's the American superpower military machine is untouchable, but he hasn't got a plan. And unfortunately, you know, Iran has game played this all the way since it last had one of these big operations back in 1984-88. It knew what was coming. It's hunkered down. It's using the Straits of Hormuz to cause havoc. And it's not going to be easy for Trump to get around this one.
Yes. I don't know anything about military strategy, but I could have predicted that Iran would close the Strait of Hormuz or make it very difficult for passage. And yet the Americans seem to have been taken by surprise.
Yes, and there'll be books written about this, Nick, I'm sure, when the US president should have said, here's the political end state I want, and look to his military to come up with a military plan to deliver that. Unfortunately, it's pretty clear at the moment that President Trump has said, I was successful in Venezuela by plucking Maduro. If I just take out the leadership, you know, we have to walk away in a heartbeat. That is just not possible. This has been, even when I was in the military, this was over 10 years ago, we used to game plan this sort of stuff. And I have played Iran in these war games. And it's pretty clear. It's not difficult to work out. You don't take on America's strength. It's pretty evident they're going to wipe you out militarily. But Iran still has its leadership in place. It still has its proxies in place. It still has over 70,000 of these Shahed drones. And it has a way of shutting the Straits of Hormuz. And it's not, even though President Trump claims that Iran has asked for talks, I'm pretty confident they haven't. They're sitting there happy going, Trump hasn't got time. They've got all the time in the world.
You mentioned the political end state that Trump might have had in mind. I mean, do you have any idea what that might actually be?
Nick, I know you're not asking me to get inside President Trump's mind, because if I could do that, I'd be a magician. At the start of this, we were listening as ex-military guys. It sounded like regime change, and it sounded like stopping Iran ever delivering nuclear weapons in the future. If a regime change was what he was seeking, within 24 hours, they had taken out all of the senior regime. And some of my serving military colleagues clearly thought that he would pause for 24 hours and just give Iran the chance to regroup and just show, look, we're serious. Version 2 can come into the leadership, but let's make it more moderate. Let's have a conversation. In fact, Mujtaba Khomeini, who had his father killed there, looks to be a version 2.0 of his father, and even more focused on vengeance. So that hasn't really worked. And in terms of the uranium enrichment, I have no doubt the American military machine will have been going after the scientists, all of the above ground facilities. But a lot of this will be buried deep underground. It's going to be really difficult to get to. And ultimately, all you can do is delay it. The only way to stop it is through political dialogue, so that you can actually negotiate and actually do checks and stuff like that. You can't deliver this with purely military action alone. And that's what President Trump is now finding.
And of course, President Trump is the one that tore up the agreement that did restrict Iran's nuclear program, and which did allow for external inspection. And presumably he tore it up because it didn't have his signature on it. And now he wants the exact same thing that he tore up before. Am I right in thinking that?
Well, it's the exact same thing. But in principle, yes, he's got to find... on a serious note, you know, America is the sort of guarantor of security for Israel. If Iran was to develop a nuclear weapon, that becomes an existential threat to Israel. So that can't be allowed to happen. The question is how best to stop it happening. President Trump seems to believe that just by using his military might, and there's been this rather tasteless videos doing the rounds that sort of demonstrating to music that the explosions going off, people getting killed. Thoroughly untasteful, because actually, you know, war is simply, you know, military machine is a means to an end, and it's not entirely clear, certainly to a military guy like me, the danger is you're making the situation worse, not better. And that's why I think our Prime Minister has been very prudent to try and keep himself out of the mangle. Let President Trump get his fingers wedged firmly in it.
But do you think that we are being painted into a corner, essentially being forced into the mangle? Because if we stay out, then we're going to be affected by it anyway.
Well, as you say, I mean, we weren't letting the Americans use Diego Garcia or RAF Fairford. But of course, now we are, because our interests are being attacked in the region as well. So we find ourselves in a slight dichotomy. But I think what's been fascinating today, President Trump is clearly trying to get wider support to try to break the blockade of the Straits of Hormuz, trying to get more countries to help with putting military ships in as escorts. Now, I've spent a fair bit of time at sea, but I'm not a naval expert. But quite frankly, that is an operation fraught with danger. The last time there were big tanker wars, I say back in the 80s, Iraq managed to attack, I think it's 411 merchant vessels, as the Americans were shwacking the Iranians every time they did it. But it lasted for years, and Iran will have learnt a lot of lessons. That's why, although America claims they've hit all their naval ships, there's loads of smaller ships hidden away in tunnels. They can pack full of explosives, drive remotely at military shipping. It would be carnage to do this in a military way, and I just don't see it working. And that's why President Trump, in a way, there's a sense of desperation about his reaching out now to international allies.
What do you make of Trump saying to the captains of oil tankers that they should just have the guts to sail through?
I think it's quite bizarre, Nick. I mean, these tankers carry huge quantities of oil. If they are struck and that oil gets released into the sea, there will be an environmental disaster. You're talking about non-military people putting their lives at risk. These tankers are not well protected. It will be very vulnerable for the crews on board. There's no way that insurance companies, which is ultimately what control of this, they will not insure them. And even if the military escorts take them through, it'll probably need America to underwrite that insurance. And even then, it'll put American warships in harm's way. That is a very narrow strait. It's pretty easy to see the ships coming. And although American warships are bristling with capabilities to defend themselves, Iran has been very effective at using quantity to overwhelm American quality. And we'll just see tens, hundreds, maybe thousands of drones fired just to actually strike these American vessels and make it very embarrassing for President Trump.
Let's talk about our military. Do we have the personnel and equipment to protect our interests abroad?
Short answer, no. If you want a longer answer, it's because for the last 35 years, ever since the end of the Cold War, we've been focused on expeditionary warfare. We fought wars away from the UK. That's largely why my generation ended up serving in Bosnia, Kosovo, Sarajevo. I did three tours in Afghanistan, 2 years of my life over there. So we had a military that was not focused on protecting our island shores because we didn't believe it was under threat. All of a sudden then, in 2022, you know, suddenly Russia goes and invades Ukraine. And all of a sudden now, massive gaps in our capability. Just simply a simple one for you, Nick. You know, we've watched these missiles being fired from Iran towards a lot of the Middle East countries. And there's lots of them being fired out of the shot out of the sky. We in the UK do not have a ballistic missile defense capability. So if Iran was to fire a ballistic missile, at the moment, at least in publicized ranges, it can't reach us. There's lots of reports that some of its test programs could. But if it was to fire one at London, we would not be able to shoot it out of the sky. That leaves us incredibly vulnerable. And that's just one example. So we're not going to be able to fix that by turning the money tap on. It's going to take a decade at least of investment. And we pretty urgently need to be getting on with it.
Just because of the geography, is it not almost impossible for such a defence system to work on an island like ours?
Well, there's lots of ways of doing it. I mean, you've got to be careful here. Sometimes you've also got to have an offence as well as a defence. And one of the roles of the military is not to fight, is to deter your nation's enemies. I spent a lot of my life, and the better equipped you are, the more professionally trained you are, the more likely it is that your enemy doesn't want to actually attack you because he sees more risk than benefit. And therefore, it's about our fighter jets. For example, we've got quick reaction alert providing 24/7 capability, 24 hours a day, 365 days a week. There's lots of capabilities we can cover. But quite frankly, we are a maritime nation. We should have anti-submarine warfare. The Navy really hasn't been focused on that. It's been focused on big carriers. What is the role of the army? Do we really want to have a big army deployed to Poland to take on Russia in a grueling war of attrition? Probably not. And do we want to make sure our air defences are a lot more robust than they are today? Absolutely should be. And if we don't invest in that technology, Nick, it leaves us weak. And all that happens, very much like Ukraine, if we do end up fighting a war, we end up putting large bodies of forces on the ground, our sons and daughters fighting our nation's enemies in a grueling war of attrition. We do not want to see that happen. We have to invest in our defence. We have to make it robust. We have to make it more a robust deterrent, and therefore that will avoid war rather than risk us getting dragged into one.
And you think that the Navy is depleted enough to be the where the money, whatever amount is spent, should be concentrated on?
I think we need a strong Navy. We're a maritime nation. A lot of our European colleagues will be focused on Russia, will provide the land defence and stuff like that. But if you look at Russia's interest in the high north and our historical excellence at sea, the Royal Navy has some amazing capabilities, particularly anti-submarine warfare. You just look at, what was it, the Iranian ship that was sunk by the US submarine? You know, shipping is incredibly vulnerable to submarine attack. Russia has loads of submarines. We need to be able to make sure we can defend against that. And that has not been a capability that we invested in for some time. So I do think there are key areas which, and unfortunately, the government commissioned a strategic defence review last year. The vision is fine, but vision without funding is hallucination. The funding part of that was the Defence Investment Plan that was due to be published in autumn, I think, last year. There's still been no sign of it. Now, frankly, the government, I suspect, is worrying about what Trump's doing, what's the future of NATO, what we should be investing in, and actually pausing because it knows it doesn't have any money. That pausing is frustrating our military chiefs because we need to be getting on with this now.
And as far as what Trump is doing now, are we already seeing mission creep? Because first it was to destroy Iran's nuclear program, then it was regime change, and then it was only airstrikes, and now it's ground troops.
Well, I think the trouble is, Nick, is that whenever our nation went to war, whether it's, I say, Kosovo, Belarus, or whatever, we would always pin our politicians down and say, it's easy to start a war, it's really difficult to finish it. So be very clear what you want, and let the military get on and create the conditions in which a political solution can flourish. I don't know President Trump well, but he doesn't look that sort of guy who takes advice. And therefore, almost certainly, he's gone in, pulled the trigger on the military action, and then found, a little bit surprised, that it isn't actually having the effect he wants. And all of a sudden now, he's having to find different ways of doing it. The one salvation is that time is not on President Trump's side. Most of the defensive missiles that are being used, the stockpiles will run very low within a period of about 10 weeks. Likewise, with the midterm elections, President Trump is looking for a way out. I wouldn't be at all surprised if in the coming weeks he announces victory, he says or claims that the Iranians are begging at his door to stop and will try to get his hands extracted from the mangle. What will have been achieved with all that conflict and that death and destruction? Well, that's for others to judge.
I mean, do you think he has in mind, with this call for a nation such as ours to provide shipping, does he have in mind subcontracting his war to us?
I wouldn't be at all surprised if he's trying to get our fingers into the mangle. I think because the more nations are involved, the more that he can divert some of the attention away from his failings to other nations' failings. I think he watched as President Maduro was plucked from Venezuela, and we haven't really heard much about that region, and therefore it looks like he's going to claim success. I think he expected to do exactly the same in Iran. This has been a long-running issue. You know, the Iranians have long been a threat, not only through their proxies, but also through this uranium enrichment program, and I think he felt it was part of his mission. The trouble is he was elected, and he's always claimed that he's the president of peace. I've solved lots of wars. He does not want his legacy to be the man who got his fingers firmly trapped in a war, an enduring war that's seeing increasing American casualties.
What about our leader? What do you make of Keir Starmer's approach to this so far?
Well, Nick, I try and steer clear of political dialogue. What I would say from a military perspective, right at the start of this, international law is very clear. It's not only the country that commits an illegal act, any country that helps them. So if we had provided air-to-air refueling or basing for American fighter jets that we knew were going to be conducting an illegal war, we would be complicit, and therefore we would be a target against Iran. To my knowledge, America has never yet demonstrated the legal case for this war, and therefore I think Sikistan was entirely appropriate in turning down the American request to use our bases. However much that might have upset President Trump, we cannot be bullied by President Trump in this. We have to make sure we tread the right line. And even now, it is not clear to me that this is a legal war. This feels like it's a Trump war. And unfortunately, at the moment, he's becoming unstuck.
And finally, do critics overstate the level of preparedness that our government should have had regarding the strikes in Cyprus on our airbase there?
I think there's a lot of political mudslinging going on, Nick. Let's be quite clear. We're talking about an attack on the military base at Cyprus, but it was one drone, and it actually hit an American hangar. It's no great secret now that the Americans have been operating U-2s out of there for a while. So the Americans have been the ones that have attacked Iran, and there was one missile or drone that ended up striking that hangar. There's been nothing before and nothing since. It was probably fired by Hezbollah. And therefore, you know, we have a lot of protections in Cyprus. I don't think we need to go a dramatically overkill because one drone has struck it. I think the far more important is we look to protect our international colleagues, both in the Middle East and our military personnel, who are serving their country with great pride and professionalism, rather than worrying about one stone that was thrown effectively at an American hangar on our base at Cyprus.
Sean, very good to talk to you. Thanks very much for your time. That's Sean Bell, former fighter pilot, now military analyst and co-host of the Red Matrix podcast. Going to take a short break and then back to your thoughts on all this. 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Conflict raging in the Middle East and the cost here in the UK.
Drivers are going to be paying £1.42.9 for a litre of unleaded and £1.55.9 for diesel.
It's panic at the pumps as the price of oil spirals. Does the government have a duty to step in?
Why doesn't the Prime Minister just stand up, admit he's got it wrong again, and scrap the fuel duty hike now?
Next week, interest will turn to the mortgage market with a key decision on interest rates. Could more pain be on the way in a flatlining economy? And did this baby speak for the nation?
Then the other thing I'm worried about, I know I'm nearly finished.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
At Ocado, you'll save 25% on your first shop and get free delivery. Which means if you were to buy a four-cheese pizza, you'd basically be getting one of the cheeses for free. Save and splurge at Ocado, the online supermarket. Geographical and other restrictions. Minimum spend £60 and charges apply. New customers only. Maximum saving £20. Terms at Ocado.com.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the sports media industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Niamh, a sports media student in Year 12.
During class, I've edited football videos for social, reported on games, and even produced my own highlight packages. Working directly with the industry makes me excited for my future career in sports broadcasting.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in Years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics, with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
1983 election, she's won a landslide second term.
Police have been deployed to disperse crowds as the poll tax riots escalate.
Credit crunches continuing to spread from the USA.
Britain has left the European Union.
I mean, this goes on. Boris, Liz,
we've Richie. Helped Britain invest through 45 years of change. That's why we're the UK's number one investment and savings platform, trusted by 2 million people. Hargreaves Lansdown, helping Britain invest for it all. Investment returns vary. For claim verification, visit hl.co.uk.
Okay. Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
We are talking about the war in Iran and specifically what our relationship to it should be. Camberwell. Hello, Claudia.
Hello, Claudia. It's been, well, I've lost my train of thought, but it will come out a little bit
Claudia, this is a very bad line. We'll try and call you back. Very, very bad line. We seem to get a lot of that. Try and call Claudia back. Meanwhile, Bournemouth. Hello, Terry.
Hi, Nick.
Terry.
A mixture of being scared and really annoyed as well with Trump and his cohort, because I think what we're looking at is being dragged in, kicking and screaming. But if we are going to get dragged in, I think what we need to do, and the rest of Europe and the rest of the world really needs to say to Trump, if you want us to bail you out, there's got to be some kind of understanding on this tariff nonsense, on all this disrespect. I mean, extract a price from him, really. I don't want to see any servicemen or women go and get their cells blown apart. But if it's unavoidable, Trump's going to have to pay, but he's going to have to pay by becoming a decent member of the world order, really, I think.
It's pretty much what Donald Trump himself would do. If the situation was reversed, then he would demand some sort of payment from us for his help. Yeah.
And there's another thing that really worries me. Where is all this WWF-style propaganda coming from? Who's actually driving that? Because when you think of all the people that have led countries to war before, they've been serious. I'm not saying they've been right, but they've been serious. They've been intelligent, and they've had a modicum of respect for the troops that are laying their lives down. But this, oh, my God, putting explosions to music and turning them into some kind of hard rock video, it's absolutely disrespectful, and it's just creepy. There's something seriously wrong there, Nick. Seriously wrong.
Well, it's as disrespectful as keeping your stupid MAGA hat on while saluting a coffin with dead army personnel inside.
Yeah, can they not get rid of him? What's this 25th Amendment? There must be something wrong with the man.
Well,
it's not for us. But
opinions differ on that, and I think that if the Democrats could have done it, then they would have done it by now. But I think
they're very quiet, though, aren't they, Nick?
I think
very
we're quiet. Stuck with him.
One thing before I go.
Yes.
I don't know if it's feasible sometime in the future when this is hopefully all over. Would it not be worth the oil companies and the Western world getting together and building some kind of Suez Canal effort to bypass that Strait of Hormuz? Because it's not actually that big a part of land. I've looked at it on the map and I thought, why didn't they build a canal years ago?
Well, they do have pipes to get the oil out in the opposite direction, but those pipes are, of course, limited by their size and
the capacity.
And they're also quite vulnerable to attack, being as how they're above the ground.
Oh, God, yeah. Frightening.
Probably the best thing in the future would be is if we didn't need oil, or if we didn't take it out of the ground and then set fire to it. And that's what we'll be talking about in the next hour, as a matter of fact.
Maybe hydrogen's the way forward. Eh? We can make that from water.
Maybe the sun. Yeah, and the
or
wind.
Maybe the sun. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, Terry. 0345 6060 973. Let's see if we can hear Claudia more clearly. Hello, Claudia.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's much better.
Yeah, I just want to say, in his desperation, in Trump's desperation to make America great again, this is what he's doing. Yeah, he's a version of Putin. This is why he's never come against Putin, because he knows that he has the same plans as Putin to invade other lands. So what he done was, he's very cunning, he invaded Venezuela, he's got their oil, because he knows that his next move was going to be against Iran, and he knows there's going to be an oil problem, so he's got his oil from Venezuela, while the rest of us are, you know. So as for, you know, sticking two fingers up at the UK and saying, oh, we don't need you now, the war's already won. Hello. And now you come back begging everybody else to help him out. When him and Netanyahu planned this behind everybody else's back, yeah?
Well, I'm not sure that, according to the Secretary of State in the States, Marco Rubio, the American government was taken surprise by the Israelis and then said that we had to join in because we felt that the Iranians would strike back at our interests, America's interests, if the Israelis struck first. And so by his account. America got dragged into it, whether they did so willingly or not.
Netanyahu does not move without Trump's say-so.
Well, the way they told it was it's the other way round. So,
no, they're telling lies. They're all telling lies.
Well, I don't doubt that.
As for, I'm going back a little bit. As for, everybody questioning the special relationship, at the end of the day, you know, when you were young people and kids and you had your best friend and for whatever reason, you know, your best friend might go off with another person and then you're not best friends anymore. At the end of the day, Trump does not respect the UK anymore, okay? He doesn't want to be best friends with us anymore. But we need to realise that he don't want to be best friends with us anymore.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Claudia. Yeah, I think this special relationship is only something that exists in our minds. Ben says we should absolutely stay out of this whole charade. However, isn't it funny how the right-wing media, who spent years berating Labour for their illegal war, are now berating Labour for not participating in an illegal war? Would you buy a car off Trump? No. Would you trust him to change the oil on your favourite motorcycle? No. This man could mess up a cup of coffee, says Ben. All right, we'll leave it there. And there are plenty more opportunities to talk about this to come on LBC, of course. But we're going to talk about energy in the next hour. Ed Miliband, the UK's Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero, says that the government's core mission is to accelerate the shift to clean, homegrown energy that Britain can control. But is the race to net zero the best response to soaring oil and gas prices, global instability and the cost of living crisis? Rejecting calls to expand fossil fuel exploration for reasons that it undermines security, Miliband says clean energy transition enhances security by reducing gas imports. Are you on board with all this? And when are you expecting the bills to go down? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. Investigations are underway in Canterbury after an outbreak of meningitis which has killed two people. The UK Health Security Agency says it's been alerted to 13 cases connected to the University of Kent. It says one of the dead was a student. The senior clinical lecturer, Professor Bharat Pankhania, has been telling LBC the scale of the infection is unusual.
Usually we get two or three, so to have 13, there has definitely been a large, what we would call, spreader event. In other words, from somewhere, someone, the infection, which is caused by a bacteria, has spread to a large number of people. And this often happens in crowded situations.
The Prime Minister has been holding talks with Donald Trump and Canada's Prime Minister on the issue of reopening the vital oil route through the Strait of Hormuz in the Gulf. Sir Keir Starmer spoke to them separately but spent time with both, discussing the disruption to global shipping because of the war in Iran. Also this evening, Downing Street says the Prime Minister will respond to the Middle East situation tomorrow by promising to protect working people from the challenges ahead. He's also due to outline plans to help those who heat their homes with oil because of spiralling prices. Israel and Lebanon are expected to hold talks over the coming days aimed at creating a durable ceasefire and disarming Hezbollah. The IDF's been targeting the south of Lebanon and parts of Beirut as part of its new attempts to destroy the Iranian-backed group. The Middle East journalist Nogatan Apolsky has been telling LBC the news is momentous, but caution is required.
In the entire history of the existence of these two states, they've never had direct talks. This is something that's been in the air in recent days. France suggested that this would be a good idea. On the other hand, Prime Minister Netanyahu has appointed Ron Dermer to lead the talks regarding Lebanon. He is someone known to drag his feet in international negotiations.
And a 27-year-old man is due in court tomorrow after being charged with the rape of a woman in West Sussex. He was arrested after reports of an attack at a car park in Worthing on Wednesday night. LBC weather, blustery showers overnight, particularly for the northwest. Some of those could be heavy, and they will turn wintry across northern hills as well. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, has unveiled new measures to boost the UK's energy security amid the Middle East war. The minister vowed to block fuel suppliers from engaging in what he called unfair practices by price gouging customers as the conflict in the Middle East continues. The war has seen the price of oil jump to $100 a barrel. Labour claims it has taken action by working with the Competition and Markets Authority to ensure that fuel suppliers cannot engage in unfair practices towards consumers, such as price gouging. It made other announcements, including the low-cost plug-in solar panels, which he hopes to roll out. Let's talk about this and related issues with Jeff Gazzard. Jeff is an environmental campaigner, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Nick.
So prices at the petrol stations have gone up. We're told that electricity and gas prices will go up. Is there price gouging going on? Are we being ripped off?
Do you know, I'm not a great fan of transatlanticisms entering into our language, but price gouging is fantastic. Clearly, it's related biblically to eye gouging, but I like price gouging. Clearly, there's oil literally in the pipeline and in storage tanks. But isn't it amazing how the moment there's a shift in price, we pay for it at the pumps? I'm going to say that is price gouging. And do you remember, you will probably remember this. Do you remember when we had a Prices and Incomes Commission? One of the things that the great Aubrey Jones did at the time, a very taciturn stoic, I think he'd been a professor of economics. You know, we had price controls on this. And I think we need to look at windfall taxes for these people. The Petrol Refining and Operators Association have bleated about how people in petrol stations are getting, you know, insulted and shouted at. I'm not sure that that's a big issue, frankly. It is if you're shouted at, but I'm not sure it's a nationwide issue of motorists taking out on people who work in petrol stations. I think that's a bit of a red herring. So, yes, price gouging does exist. Motorists and hauliers and everybody who buys fossil fuel for their vehicle pays it. So there we are. I would switch to an electric vehicle if I were you. Slightly more resilient in terms of price gouging.
Yeah, the Chancellor has been asked, to put it mildly, to abandon the tax rise on petrol, but it's only 1p in September, 2p in December, and another 2p next March. I mean, that's too far off for any of this to matter now, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we've had a standstill on petrol duty and diesel fuel increases. We used to have an escalator, if you remember. And I think it must be probably 6 to 8 years, if not longer, since any government of any colour has actually put that escalator on, which, of course, was to encourage the switch to EVs and also for both the improvement of air quality, let alone climate change reasons. So I'm all for a slight moderate phased increase in VAT and duty on fossil fuels, because it will encourage people to buy electric vehicles, which, whether we like it or not, and I certainly like it, are the future.
Yes, doesn't this war actually underscore that we need to rid ourselves of our addiction to fossil fuels as quickly as possible?
Well, I'm going to say a big yes to that in a renewable electricity powered 40-foot high neon sign above the M6 at Junction 19. You know, I'm just going to plug it in now because it's only just up the road from me. I would say that, wouldn't I? But why would I say that? Can I give you an amazing success? Last year saw the closure of our last coal-fired electricity-generated power station at Ratcliffe-on-Soar. That's taken us 140 years to decoal our industry, our domestic electricity supply, with absolute benefits for climate change and air quality. And to replace that, we've created jobs in offshore wind turbine installation and maintenance. We've created jobs similarly in onshore wind farms. We've created jobs in hydropower research, et cetera, et cetera. And we are on target to generate 50% of our electricity this year from renewable sources. Now, that does include the environmentalist old bugbear of nuclear, which you could, if you were being extraordinarily generous, say it's renewable, but it ain't cheap, and of course you've got huge decommissioning costs. As you have huge decommissioning costs with anything. You know, you have decommissioning costs when you've got to take down the wind turbines that need replacing. But overall, we are, as a nation, we've got rid of coal. It's taken us 140 years. That's real success in the bank. We generated 50% of our electricity last year from renewable sources, including nuclear. And nuclear is important. I'm not going to be a hair shirt green on this because we need base load, and that's what gas provides and provides us with. But switching away from gas is what we must do, and we are doing. I mean, I would not have believed, frankly, in my lifetime that I'd have seen us ending coal, which we did last year for electricity generation, and producing 50% of yours and mine and everybody else's UK electricity from renewable sources, solar, wind, and all the rest of it.
Yes, and yet the price of the electricity produced by solar and wind is at the price of the fallback form of energy, which is gas.
Well, that's marginal costing and the way the electricity market works, which is strike pricing. I am not going to bore myself or you or your listeners by going into that because it is ridiculously complex and I think is largely overdue for massive reform. The reason why this happens is because of the volatility of the international market for gas, whether it's affected by Donald Trump's escapades in the Middle East or the war in Ukraine. That's when we get price spikes in gas. That's a question of supply and demand, and dare I say it, we're coming back to that inimitable phrase, a bit of price gouging. The one thing that is steady in terms of some pricing, in terms of supply, are renewables. But the electricity market is incredibly complex. Notwithstanding those complexities, we've still managed to get rid of coal. We've still managed to generate 50% of our electricity supply from renewables, and these are wind. Now, you have to set that investment against the subsidies. Now, I think probably rightly, in terms of everybody's pockets, we spent in the last gas price, the Ukraine war-inspired gas price, something like £58 billion in subsidies to UK consumers. And that's a cost that people forget about because they almost think that's a rite of passage. Electricity prices go up enormously. It's the Ukraine war. The government steps in and gives us all a bit off our bills, and they're supposed to come down again by 114 quid again this summer. I'm not sure what will happen in terms of the skirmish in the Persian Gulf, impact on that. So it's incredibly complex. I'm not belittling it, or yourself, or indeed my grasp of economics, but the electricity market does need reform, there's no question about it. One of the ways of ensuring the security of both cost, price, investment and supply is to be in charge of your own renewables, not relying on gas from external sources, be it Norway or Russia or the Netherlands or where have you.
And am I right in thinking that Spain relies on gas about the least of any country in Europe and has benefited because of that?
That's true. Now, Spain, in terms of solar, is clearly a Mediterranean country. It has, huge hours of sunlight, as do we, in a sense, but we don't have the kind of ability to generate that consistently as they do. The thing that overcomes the intermittency of both wind and solar, and let's face it, there are days that aren't quite so sunny as the Costa Brava, particularly in northwest England, where we've had a biblical more than 40 days rain. But you're right, and you overcome that by batteries, and you increase battery technology. You increase the storage facilities for this. And you can do that, by having an EV, and if you keep your battery topped up on your EV, you can plug some of that back into the grid. You can have batteries and heat pumps in your own home to cut down on gas. I'm sitting from a house now where I have an 8K heat pump hanging off the wall at the back of my three-bedroom, quite a large three-bedroom estate, 1970s-type house. Cost me about £4.73 a day in the winter time. I've got 9 solar panels on my roof as well, which contributes to that. I'm getting a battery over this summer because they're a bit cheaper in the summer. So that is all part of the government's policy, and I think everybody is getting that. Heat pump installations are up, solar panels for domestic insulation are up. Look at the impact of electric vehicles and the scale that they're having. Chargers everywhere. We have a big, literally called truck stop motorway service area up at Lyme, about 5 miles from where I'm sitting. And I think they've just put in another 40 EV chargers there. And they don't do that, you know, for health reasons. Well, they do, because there's less emissions, but they do it to make money out of it because the demand is there and EV penetration is growing. So if you put all that together, and the other thing, and people make a point, is, well, all this extra use of electricity, which is a very good point, means by probably the 2030s, we may be using 50% more electricity than we are at the moment. That's why we have to invest in renewables, 50% more electricity than we're using right now, because of the growth in heat pumps and electric vehicles, which need electricity to supply to keep them functioning. So, complex situation, reform the market, keep investing in renewables. Gas can do a runner, as with coal. It's not an easy transition. It's not cost-free. We have to build new power lines and all the rest of it, you know. But I think everybody gets this. And more power to all politicians, including all the governments of the last 14, 16, 15, 18, 20 years, who have progressed our shift as a nation away from coal to renewables, which is a major success. And well done us.
What do you think of the idea, Ed Miliband, to roll out these small solar panels that people can put on balconies and in small outdoor spaces? What kind of a difference would that actually make to people's bills and their lives?
Well, that to me is an element of asking for trouble, because who wants solar panels, you know, on every balcony? What we should do is we should...
Sorry to interrupt, but why, yeah, why would that cause trouble?
Oh, well, because people are going to have, they're just going to be an eyesore. You can remember when every house had a Sky TV and satellite dish, and we don't have that anymore, and thank God for that. There's an easy solution to solar panels in the domestic environment. Retrofit them on your roofs, but even more importantly, because everybody has roofs, you know, I've got 9 panels on my roof. You can't see them, you know, unless you're flying over my house, which is another story. But the thing about solar panels is we should be mandating every new build house, every new build apartment block, to have not just solar panels, but heat pumps as well. I have no idea why house builders are so against that, because it isn't a lot of money per house, either heat pumps, let alone solar panels, which are getting cheaper as you and I speak.
Should we be aiming at achieving net zero or making ourselves energy independent? And are the two necessarily, do they necessarily correspond?
I think economically and politically they should correspond, and also from an investment viewpoint. I think the only fly in the ointment about getting to net zero is, you know, what do you do about carbon capture and storage, which is a big part of this government's plan and previous government's plan. I'm not a huge fan of carbon capture and storage, simply because it's a diversion from the real thing, which is moving to renewables, as we've just discussed. You asked me about Spain. Of course, Spain is, you know, literally a beacon of light. They've decided to close their coal mines, as we have done. They've decided to go big on solar because they can. They also have some interesting ideas on salt-based storage systems and all the rest of it, which you have to have. And, I mean, our residual base supply at the moment, in case of an emergency, is fields full of diesel generators. You've probably seen them. And I don't think that's a good idea. So in terms of the strictness of our policy, we are operating similarly to most European countries. The country in the world that's cutting its emissions at the fastest rate and implementing solar at a rate that's just phenomenal is, of course, China. And they are starting to reduce their coal consumption too. So the other thing that people say is, why should we go it alone? We're only, you know, 0.8% of global CO2 or whatever it is. And the answer is, we're not going it alone. Whatever you see about Donald Trump counseling, you know, the American contribution to climate change and the UNFCCC and the IPCC and all the rest of the UN bodies that set the policies and the research and that we all sign up to, in the UK's case, legally, it's all a nonsense. You know, the whole of the world, India and China, are looking at solar. We are doing that as well. And to get back to my point about balconies, I don't think you need it on balconies. You can have mini solar or mini turbines if you want them. But to me, the fundamental thing here is to get solar on everybody's roofs, and particularly to get the National House Builders Council, who are so anti this, it's hard to believe, to get solar on the roofs of every new build house and apartment block starting tomorrow. And even that's not soon enough for me.
Very good to talk to you, Jeff. Thanks so much for that. That's the environmental campaigner, Jeff Gazzard. So what do you make of that? What do you think of Ed Miliband's push to take us off our addiction to fossil fuel? And correspondingly, what do you think of certain politicians who seem determined to keep us on fossil fuel? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
Taxis changing. From April 2026.
If you're a sole trader or a landlord
with a turnover above £50,000,
you'll need to use recognised software to keep records
and send quarterly updates of your income and expenses.
There's no avoiding it. Tax is changing. Get ready. Search HMRC Making Tax Digital.
Wrong tool for the job? Don't make that mistake with your van. Get up to 30% off selected new Toyota vans and pickups with a warranty up to 10 years or 100,000 miles with every qualifying routine service. Visit your nearest Toyota centre or visit toyota.co.uk/van savings for more details. Savings on selected vans and pickups ordered by the 31st of March 2026. UK residents, see toyota.co.uk for full details. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Ed Miliband wrote a column for The Observer. He said, as conflict in the Middle East pushes up global oil and gas prices, families will be worrying about the impact on bills here in the UK. Well, he's got that right. He says the government's number one priority is to tackle the affordability crisis. That's why we acted in the budget to bring down bills, funded by asking the wealthiest to pay their fair share, with these savings locked in till July. At every moment of this crisis, we will fight people's corn and blah, blah, blah. That's just politicking. He said, we will also act on the single most important long-term lesson. While we are so dependent on fossil fuels, households, businesses and public finances are exposed. And that is absolutely true, isn't it? I mean, we know this from the war in Ukraine. It sent the price at the petrol pump skyrocketing. In fact, there were queues to try to fill up your car. I managed to, I can remember leaving this show just in, the first part of the war there, and driving for about 2 hours at 2 o'clock in the morning to try to find a petrol station that didn't have queues outside of it going around the block. So it's a very visual and hurtful sign that our addiction to fossil fuels is certainly leaving us vulnerable, at the very least. Global event, this is Ed Miliband. Global events demonstrate there's not a moment to waste in our drive for clean power. But other politicians from other parties say that this is completely the wrong direction, and that we should be drilling more oil and gas out of the North Sea, and that net zero is stupid, and that we should continue to burn oil as fast as we possibly can. So there's two opinions there. Which side do you fall on? 0345 6060 973. Chislehurst. Hello, John.
Hello, sir.
John.
Ed Miliband really hasn't looked into this and all the facts and the actual figures. I've got multiple solar panels. Now, on a sunny day, you'll get random clouds come over. Those solar panels will drop to less than 5% output. Now, if I use only 3 kilowatts a day, I need to make 500 watts an hour. In order to do that, I'm going to need 10,000 watts of solar. If I use 6 kilowatts of electricity a day, I'm going to need 20,000 watts of solar. Because it just doesn't work.
How old are your solar panels?
They're new.
That seems very odd. So you're not really getting anything from them at all if there's a cloud in the sky?
No, they drop right down. There's only one solar panel that I know of that can actually do that, that can actually make good power. And it's an American brand.
Right. Well, what about the storage of solar? Because that's the key, isn't it? It's with a system that is on and off, like the sun and the wind and so on, it's storing it while the time is good in order to use it when, you know, it's nighttime and the wind has dropped.
Yeah, you can do that. I've got solar generators, so I've got about six of the things where I can store about 8 kilowatts of power, which is fine for my use because I use low-watt appliances, but a regular home doesn't. You can't heat your home with... unless you've got a lot of solar, because a 2,000 watt heater or even a 1,000 watt heater is going to suck a battery dry in less than an hour. If you've got an 80 ampere hour battery, that's about 1,100 odd watts. It's going to eat that battery. So if you've got 10 of those, that'll give you 10 kilowatts of power. But the problem with that is you can only use those batteries down to 50%. So you're going to need 20 batteries, not 10.
I'll admit that I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about, really. I'm unfamiliar with the technology. I've never had solar power or a turbine or any of these things. And I don't really know my electricity. But are you sure that your kit is working well?
My kit's state of the art, but right. The silly part about it is, me and my brother, we actually went out and bought a really good wind turbine. When we came to install it, we looked at the council bylaws, and it has to be within not closer than 30 metres of any boundary. Now, I don't know anyone who's got a garden that is 30 metres in every direction. That's if you stick it slap bang in the middle of the garden.
Well, it sounds like you've made a tremendous effort in order to go green or to be energy independent, and your experience is not that great.
No, well, my get around that is to buy everything in low wattage form, like my tumble dryer uses 800 watts, but it switches on, switches off, and cycles as it works. My washing machine, I bought a camping washing machine because it uses hardly no power. I use a 4x4 freezer that uses a third of what a normal fridge freezer uses.
You really have made an effort.
Well, my air fryers use under 1,000 watts. Now, that cycles on and off, so I can roast the chicken, a whole chicken, and use less than 400 watts of electricity, as opposed to putting the chicken in a 2,000 to 3,000 kilowatt oven.
Do you find that you can heat your home with the kit that you've got?
No, you need masses of solar to do that.
So how do you heat your home?
I use propane.
Right.
It's the only other option I've got, unless I want to start handing money over to British Gas.
Have you taken all these measures because you're not connected to the grid?
I am connected to the grid. I just prefer not to give my money to other people.
Right.
I've got every appliance everybody else has got, but mine are low wattage versions.
Yeah, right.
And you've got to do that. You can't just wallop a couple of solar panels on your patio or on your balcony in a block of flats.
Right, and expect it to actually run your flat or your house. Yes, but would it be, somewhat beneficial? And if you take that somewhat and multiply it by all of the homes in the land, then you really do have something.
Well, we put two 260-watt solar panels in my brother's garden. In order to recharge one of these solar generators, which has a capacity of 1,800 watts as storage, it can take up to 10 to 16 days under British weather conditions, feeding it with 520 watts of solar. It just can't be done. You can't do it by whopping on solar panels. You need, if you're going to use a minimum of 3,000 watts a day, in other words, 3 kilowatts, you're going to need 10,000 watts of solar in order for you to
I will admit that I really don't have any notion of the scale of what it is that you're talking about, having no experience of any of this technology, but it sounds like for you, you've done everything right, seemingly, and it's still not quite sufficient. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate that. 0345 6060 973. Do you have any experience of any of this kit? It seems that everything on Earth has been powered by the sun. It's our inability to make solar panels efficient enough to power our lives that's the problem. And there's nothing wrong with the sun. It's that solar panels aren't quite there yet. I mean, if a tree can use the sun to go to build itself 100 foot high and live for 200 years, then surely we can get a small car to go to Tesco's and back on that same power. It's perhaps not quite there yet. But do you have any experience with this kit? And what do you make of Ed Miliband's idea to get these small solar panels that you can buy in a supermarket and put in any outside space on the balcony of your flat or a tiny, in the yard at the back of your back door? Is that going to make a difference? Have you actually used one of these things? And do you have a different experience to the chap that I've just been speaking to? 0345 6060 973. Going to take a break for the news. Come back with more of your thoughts on this. We're also going to talk about fake food. Now, that's not how they're going to sell it to us, but that's essentially what might be on a supermarket shelf near you soon. Laboratory-grown food. Just past 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Investigations have begun in Canterbury after an outbreak of meningitis which has killed two people. The UK Health Security Agency says it's been alerted to 13 cases connected to the University of Kent. Downing Street says the Prime Minister's held discussions with Donald Trump and Canada's Prime Minister on the issue of reopening the vital oil route through the Strait of Hormuz. Sir Keir Starmer spoke to them separately but spent time with both talking about the disruption to global shipping because of the war in Iran. And a 27-year-old man is due in court tomorrow after being charged with the rape of a woman in Worthing. He was arrested after reports of an attack at a car park last week. LBC weather, blustery showers overnight, particularly in the northwest. They could be heavy at times and they could turn wintry. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. They will affect how you manage your tenancies. Act now. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2025 Amazon packaging data across the UK and EU.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person, or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK, retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Lab-grown foie gras and chicken are being tested by scientists to ensure that they are safe for humans to eat. And they could hit British restaurants and dinner tables within the next 5 years. It's apparently the closest that any such cultivated meat product has yet come to approval for human consumption in the UK, so say the Food Standards Agency. Other products like edible insects, 3D-printed chocolate, vegetables with extra vitamins and cheese that's brewed in a lab could also reach the public relatively shortly. Let's talk about this with Professor Giles Yeo, MBE. Professor Yeo is from the Department of Clinical Biochemistry at the University of Cambridge and is the author of Why Calories Don't Count, How We Got the Science of Weight Loss Wrong. Good evening, Professor.
Good evening. Thank you for having me on.
I appreciate your time. The press are going to call this Frankenfoods. Could we be creating a monster? How do we know what the long-term effects of eating lab-grown foods will be?
Look, I mean, if the lab-grown foods are just that, because because we have the ability to take cells from anywhere and sort of grow them. And so the reality is, if we're just growing them, then actually they're probably not genetically modified, right? So it's just going to be a different way of growing the cells that are going to be in different animals. So I think as long as they show that it's safe and the stuff that's growing in, you know, all the safety things are met, I see this no different to actually having something, you know, carved off a cow, for example.
And the UK Food Standards Agency have been given £1.6 million by the government to determine whether these foods are safe. That doesn't sound like a lot of money, is it?
It doesn't sound like a lot of money, but I don't think you need a lot, because what happens is you grow a little bit, right? So the main issue with these lab-grown meats, to my mind, is not going to be the safety, because we can check them, we can tweak them, and we could do them in small amounts. So they're very cheap to actually do sort of in a lab. I mean, we use I don't make meat, but we take human stem cells and convert them into human brain cells and actually work on them. And so we can do it on a small scale. The challenge will be to scale this so that it's cheaper than actually growing a cow. That's where the challenge is going to come from. So to me, 1.6 million to test the safety, you know, in terms of in principle, sounds like it will probably do a job.
And they talk of lab-grown pork and lab-grown chicken. What exactly are they?
So they would be, okay, if it's pork or chicken, they're going to be cells that come from either a pig or a chicken. And you just optimize. So rather than growing it, you know, on the sort of like a skeleton of an animal, what you do is you grow them in a dish. So typically you would put some kind of matrix so it can bind to something. And then you sort of just grow the cells. You just need to know the conditions in which to actually grow the cells. The difficulty, however, so you can achieve things like mints, stuff that's all minced up. I think we're probably going to be closer to getting there. Foie gras, things like that. What's difficult is making a steak. Now, the reason why it's difficult to make a steak is because of the texture. And our muscles, not our muscles, an animal's muscle tastes like it does because they move, they use it. And so I know, for example, people are now actually putting these lab-grown meats between electrical currents to try and mimic them actually being used. So that's what it is. You just take cells from specific animals and you kind of grow them.
And do you think that they're going to be actually advertised as lab-grown? Because that might come up against some consumer resistance.
So I think there's probably two things. You're absolutely right. There's a marketing issue. It's like saying things have insects in anything, right? Going to go, I'm not going to want to eat it. Maybe it'll be different for our kids. At the moment, I probably pick some legally allowed marketing term that doesn't say lab grown, because I think it will put some people off. Definitely not Frankenfood. That'd be maybe as a joke. Here's your Frankenburger. I think from a marketing perspective, perhaps. But I think it's just a cultural thing, because if we actually get to the stage that it's safe and you can do it at scale, listen, it would mean environmentally this would be just so much better. Whether or not we can achieve this economically, we'll have to see.
We mentioned insects. Insects are eaten in some Asian countries. Could the Western diet start to introduce insects? I mean, if they were trying to come up with a name, they could call them land prawns, maybe.
Have you had an insect? Have you had a cricket or a grasshopper before?
No, I have not.
So I've had that sort of deep fried in in Southeast Asia. And it's sort of like eating a deep fried prawn head, which I like to eat. And so, look, I think once again, I think there's a cultural acceptance of it, which I think is fine, because you got to get past that, right? I think initially for things like insects, you'd probably sort of use the protein space from insects in order to enhance certain things or to make something more protein rich rather than actually selling you a grasshopper, for example.
And you've mentioned price. How easy do you think it will be to scale up to the point that what they're growing in a laboratory or factory or wherever is going to become cheaper than what people might call normal food?
I don't know. I think there's going to be, we're nowhere close to that. Okay. I think if we get this approved from a safety perspective, it may or may not begin to match the prices of some of the more rare meats, okay, that are out there that are actually, because the animals are rare, it's very expensive anyway. I think for things like cattle and chickens, and the kind of stuff that we eat on a daily basis, at the moment, I don't know if we have the technology to do the scale that we need to drive down the prices. But that being said, if suddenly it becomes, well, first of all, it becomes legal and people are willing to eat it and there's a market for it. You never underestimate the ingenuity, the ingenuity of human beings, I think.
And part of the necessity would be that if we created enough lab-grown meat to meet the existing demand of real meat, it would massively affect our national food security, wouldn't it?
It would, because I don't think every country would be able to. Well, it would definitely be good for the country being able to do it. I think the ability to actually grow this, having the facilities in every country in the world, this is a long way away yet. So once again, if we are able to do it, I think, first of all, that would be great. I still think there will be a situation, like with most technologies, where some countries will not be able to actually achieve this. But if you have it, then there is some element of food security there, yes.
And would the techniques that we're talking about allow people to produce completely novel types of food that we don't ordinarily have?
Ah, like in what sense? You don't want to start creating different creatures. That does begin to then different types of life. I think, I don't know if we can do that, but...
Well, what we've been talking about is sort of mimicking chicken or pork and so on. But would it actually have to do that, or could they just have some sort of generic meat of no fixed abode?
You know, I've often thought of another thing. This is slightly macabre, maybe for this time of the evening. Would you eat a meat burger? I mean, could I scrape some skin off myself and actually create a burger made out of me? But it's not actually, like, you know what I mean? And so I think that's the kind of question you're asking. That I think it's a rather philosophical question, because nothing is going to be harmed from this, right? You're going to take cells from somewhere, and then you're going to be able to convert them into sort of the muscle-type cells or whatever you're trying to create, liver, if you're making foie gras, and then grow them and eat them. So the source animal might have had a little tick, you know, like a little bit of a pinprick, and then suddenly you're able to grow all these things. There is going to be no suffering from anything or anyone. So I think we can create what we want if it's viable and if it's safe.
So it isn't actually going to appeal to vegetarians or vegans. It doesn't actually come from an animal, but it still has an animal basis.
You see, that's an interesting question. So, okay, I am not a vegetarian or vegan. Would a vegetarian or vegan consider lab-grown meat, meat, if no animals have come to harm from it? So I think that's probably slightly more philosophical. Then you may as well just do a lab-grown plant, right? Because if you're going to do it, you know, at the moment, what do? We eat things like the Impossible Burger, right? Where you're able to actually get a burger that bleeds and things like that. And that is vegan. So I think it's a philosophical question. I think you need to ask sort of someone who is currently a vegan or vegetarian what they think about it. I think it would be vegan or vegetarian because, once again, no animal has come to harm from this.
And can you imagine that the process of creating this food would actually be less deleterious to the environment than the farming methods that we are using at the moment?
Okay. Now it depends on the technology, because obviously you still need big incubators, you still need a place that is safe and clean, you know, AC needs to be pumped in and things like that. So we'll have to look at the whole cycle of sort of from dish to plate rather than from farm to fork. And let's see what that is. I mean, I assume it's going to be possible, but I'm not qualified to actually make that judgment about sort of like the environmental impacts of that. But I would imagine if you could actually sort of calculate that, look, it's an empirical number. We'll be able to figure it out.
It all sounds like highly processed food, which is the type of thing that we're being told not to eat.
I mean, this is my, you know, you see, now you open a can of worms. Look, I agree that we're told not to eat highly processed foods. I'm not a big fan of the term, the UPFs. I think it's too broad a church. So I think we have here a situation where if we can show that these foods are just, you're trying to just make some kind of lab-grown pork or something. You haven't added any salt, sugar, fat, anything else in it. So I think as long as it's safe, it is going to be ultra-processed by its very definition because you've grown it in a lab. But I think this would sit under the ultra-processed food categories that are perfectly fine for you but are technically ultra-processed.
And the speed at which things are changing, can you see a time when we might be producing our own food to order in our kitchens with tabletop machines?
So sort of like a replicator, a food replicator in Star Trek.
Mm, yes.
Look, I think we're able, given that we are now able to do 3D printing even on a box that's probably the size of a old school PC on a desk, I think that if we begin to understand enough about it so that we don't even have to grow sort of the things, we can actually 3D print the food. I know it's a bit Star Trek-y, and it's a little bit in the future. It's not as Star Trek-y as you might imagine. I think it probably is not impossible.
Very good to talk to you, Professor. Thanks so much for your time. That's Professor Giles Yeo, MBE, from the Department of Clinical Biochemistry at the University of Cambridge. He is the author of Why Calories Don't Count, How We Got the Science of Weight Loss Wrong. So, exciting stuff coming to your dinner plate near you soon. Going to take a short break and then back to your thoughts about Ed Miliband and his drive to net zero and to get this country off its addiction to fossil fuels.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. Conflict raging in the Middle East and the cost here in the UK.
Drivers are going to be paying £1.42.9 for a litre of unleaded and £1.55.9 for diesel.
It's panic at the pumps as the price of oil spirals. Does the government have a duty to step in?
Why doesn't the Prime Minister just stand up, admit he's got it wrong again and scrap the fuel duty hike now?
Next week, interest will turn to the mortgage market with a key decision on interest rates. Could more pain be on the way in a flatlining economy? And did this baby speak for the nation?
Then the other thing I'm worried about, I know I'm nearly finished.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg. Flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. They will affect how you manage your tenancies. Act now. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
Think of a date that's special to you. Now imagine if that date won you a life-changing £1 million. Every week with a birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1 or via post. Enter by midnight tonight and your special date could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only, no purchase necessary.
Chase is the digital bank that boosts your savings to 4.5% AER variable.
A boost?
Yep. It includes a 2.25% AER boost for the first 12 months.
Are they being boosted now?
All the time. Bedtime, gym time, romantic dinner time. And soon you could boost your way to...
Ah, beach time.
Boost your savings with Chase. Search Chase Boosted Saver. 18 plus UK residents available to new Chase current account customers for their first 31 days. 4.41% gross interest paid monthly. Eligibility and T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
The Energy Secretary Ed Miliband wrote a column in The Observer. He said, global events demonstrate there's not a moment to waste in our drive for clean power. What do you make of that? 0345 6060 973. Nuneaton. Hello, Paul.
Hello, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
So, just wanted to touch on a fantastic subject about people who are basically living on net zero. And I'm someone myself who's actually achieved that. So I live full-time in an American RV, so living off solar is pretty critical to me. But one thing none of your previous callers have alluded to is the fact that if you're going to invest in solar, you need to do it seriously, and you need something called silicon dioxide solar panels. And most people, when they talk about solar, will search eBay and buy a couple of panels like your previous caller, but to do it seriously requires a big investment.
Well, my previous caller, to be fair to him, it did seem like he had invested in a lot of kit.
Just by him explaining that he uses low-power wattage outlets means that he's running on a very kind of low-wattage system. But silicon dioxide solar panels cost an extremely large amount of money. But to actually invest in that, for most people, they wouldn't make up the savings that solar would give them in their lifetime, if that makes sense. So sort of a chicken and egg scenario. But for me, I run 95% completely off-grid, and, you know, I live in quite a large American RV, you know, 40-foot plus, and, you know, all modern appliances. But it's that initial outlay in the kit, and this is the big stumbling block for most people, is they'll call up a local solar provider and they'll give them a quote, but it's sort of off-the-shelf parts which are fairly accessible and affordable, but they don't give you that return straight away. And the more you sort of go up the solar panel spectrum, the more expensive it becomes. But then that capital outlay, most people won't ever get back in their lifetime.
Well, give us an idea of how much. Give us an idea of how much you spend.
You're talking around about £20,000 to £25,000 to do it right, and that's including having batteries and inverters. So for someone like myself, who it's kind of mission critical, but if you're, you know, mid-terraced house in suburbia, £25,000 versus potentially, you know, just paying that in energy bills, you can see the sort of dilemma most people face.
Yeah, and so that's £20,000 just to run the equipment that you've got in a recreation vehicle, they call it in America, don't they?
Yes, because they're much larger. But I made the choice to sort of exit, you know, the rat race, if that were the phrase. So yeah. I decided that I didn't want to continue paying a mortgage for the rest of my life and, you know, extortionate council tax rates. So I used the money from my house saving to buy the RV and the initial outlay in that equipment. But now I don't have any bills.
Sounds great. What happens when it's not sunny?
Well, this is the thing. The initial outlay that you spend is for the silicon dioxide solar panels, but also the batteries to store it. And this is the other thing,
right,
is, you know, having the right batteries. So you can buy an off-the-shelf solar panel from eBay for £150 for 200 watts, then you can buy a battery. But the same kit, if you were to do the silicon dioxide panels and the right leisure batteries, would be, you know, £2,000. So 200% times more expensive. But then again, it's the professional kit that's needed. And the current stuff that's installed on people's houses is more to A, meet government efficiency grants, and B, to be at the market price needed to be able to sell them to most people.
Right.
But would you spend £20,000-£25,000 on just solar panels to potentially make that investment back at the in your lifetime?
No.
And this is where obviously the big problem is for most people who want to make that choice. But as with all technology, Moore's Law, you know, it doubles every year, so the price of this technology should fall. But then again, like anything, you know, if you were to have bought an EV car at the beginning when they first kicked off, they were free of charge, and now even the cheapest, smallest EV is taxed at £20. So it's that dilemma, how long do you sort of battle before the government intervene and say, well, actually, this is costing us too much money.
Yes, and how long do you wait before you're not an early adopter anymore? Well, that's very interesting, Paul. Thanks so much for that. That's, it's a success, but it comes at a cost. I mean, it seems logical to me that as fast as things are in changing and improving, that solar panels will start to become much more efficient and much cheaper. I mean, that has to be the way that market is going, surely. Then the question remains, when to jump in? Camborne. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there.
Daniel.
Good to speak to you, Nick. Tuned in just as you were doing your interview about Trump.
Oh, yes.
Which I thought was absolutely superb. Anyway, onto the solar.
Yeah.
I ended up living on a boat down in Cornwall back in about 2006. And at that point, an 80-watt solar panel was £250. And the price is now...
Oh. Presumably he's using electricity of some sort to call us, and that's just failed him. Well, I guess we'll never know unless we can get him back. Let's try and get him back, and we'll find out what that price is going to be. East Yorkshire, hello, Mike.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, solar panels.
Yes.
I'm going to come in somewhere in between your pessimistic guy and the guy saying it costs £20,000.
Right.
My daughter had a solar setup on her roof. Now, her roof faces east-west rather than south, so she had a double setup, one facing east, one facing south. Two batteries, but the key to the system is her husband designs AI systems for industry, and the whole system is rigged up to a computer which trades electricity 24 hours a day with the grid. So, the system, and they also plug the cars into this. So, if they're both home at tea time, and there's a surge on the grid, and the grid is paying top coins, say 17p a unit, it will empty the batteries and empty their cars into the grid. It will then charge them from the grid overnight at 7.5p. It also monitors the weather, and it monitors which day of the week it is and when high demand is likely. So when high demand's coming up, it ensures the batteries are full, empties them into the grid at top coin, and then charges them via both the solar or maybe overnight on cheap electricity. The system costs £11,500, and it makes a profit of £3,500 a year.
Wow. Count me in.
So it works, and it also helps the grid because it stabilizes the grid. When the grid is short of power, it pumps electricity back into the grid. When the grid has got excess power, it will use that to charge the batteries overnight if necessary. And if I can just do a quick one on this balcony solar stuff.
Yeah.
It's a good investment for people. It's not going to save the earth or make you a fortune. But if you spend £400 on the system, if your balcony faces south, don't do it if your balcony faces north, but if you can put the solar panel in a good position, it will make a quarter of its value each year, so you're making 25%. So if you pay £400, it'll knock £100 off your electricity bill.
Right. Well, I think at that level, rather than waiting for 20 years to go by before you make your money back, if you can make your money back in 4 years, I think that becomes much more attractive.
Well, it does. Just think, if you've got an ISA, you're probably getting 5%.
Yes.
If you've got £400, it might be worth a punt on one of these systems, because right, it will make you 25% a year.
Yes. Very interesting. Thanks so much for that, Mike. 0345-6060-973. Let's see if we can get Daniel back, and he can tell us what it was that he was about to say. Daniel.
Sorry about that, Nick. I don't know what happened. I am on a mobile. Yeah, I just wanted to give you my perspective because I ended up living on a boat and then I didn't have any grid electricity. All I had was a BT line and I just had to figure it out as I went along. Hmm. And back then, an 80-watt panel, this is off-grid, obviously, was £250. Now, the prices have plummeted if you know where to look. So if you go on to City Plumbing, you can now get a 515-watt panel for £91.87.
Well, give us an idea of what that kind of a panel could can do.
Well, it's 515 watts, so it's quite a large panel that can charge your battery quite quickly.
Right,
so
but can I run a two-bed flat off it, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, it depends how much you really want to do. So I've got two panels similar to this on my 8x6 garden shed. I've got one on each side of the shed. I've got a charge controller that costs about £60 now, which is very cheap. So your batteries go to your charge controller. That then charges your lithium, you know, a decent lithium battery. And the one I've got, I mean, you know, as soon as you're generating heat, you are going to deplete that battery. But I don't know what that guy was saying about you can only run it to 50%. That's with the old style lead acid, like car batteries. Mm. We're now on to, you know, higher tech lithium batteries.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's all come down in price. It really is unbelievable. And, you know, I've had to figure that out and configure it myself. It's not that hard. If you go on YouTube and type in off-grid solar, there's all sorts of instructions there. So if you want to do it the cheap way, I did all of that for under £1,000.
Huh.
And now I can run anything that's 24 volt straight from those batteries. Or you can use an inverter, which changes the 24 volt to 40 volt. And then I can run anything up to 2,000 watts, you know, and anything like a light or running a laptop. I mean, you know, it's just pumping it out.
Right.
It's great.
Well, yeah. I have to believe that this is the future, that the future is solar. And that the our ability to produce efficient solar panels is at its infancy. I think, you know, solar panels will become invisible, apart from anything else. There won't be these sort of hideous panels on top of your roof. It'll just look like tiles. And they'll become as normal to have on a house as windows. But in the meantime, as I mentioned before, Ed Miliband is making efforts to at least to do something to get us off our addiction to fossil fuel, because that is obviously, you know, you've seen the price of petrol. Any unstable moment in the Middle East, and there seems to be nothing but unstable moments in the Middle East, is going to be a shock to us. Thanks for all that. We're going to go for the news and then change it up afterwards. That last chap mentioned YouTube, and YouTube is in the dock in California, accused of making kids addicted to its products. Specifically, Meta and Google are in the middle of a six-week-long court case in Los Angeles, accused of creating addicts out of children. What's your experience with social media? Do you think it is actually addictive? Or are the social media companies just giving people what they want? 0345 6060 973, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10, Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom.
The University of Kent has confirmed a student is one of the two people who died following a meningitis outbreak in Canterbury. The UK Health Security Agency is now investigating after being alerted to 13 cases. The university says it's working closely with public health teams. Dr. Tom Nutt is the chief executive of the charity Meningitis Now.
The most common kind of the disease at the moment, which is MenB, well, anyone in those teenage young adult years, they won't have had a vaccine that is now available for infants on the NHS. And that's why students and young adults need to be particularly aware of the risks of meningitis.
The French president has told his Iranian counterpart to stop Tehran's attacks against countries in the Gulf region. Emmanuel Macron has been talking to Masoud Pezeshkian. Writing online, he also says freedom of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz must be restored as quickly as possible. But the military analyst Sean Bell's been telling Nick Abbott on LBC that is Tehran's main bargaining chip.
Iran has gameplayed this all the way since it last had these one of these big operations back in 1984-88. It knew what was coming. It's hunkered down. It's using the Straits of Hormuz to cause havoc. And it's not going to be easy for Trump to get around this one.
Five people have been injured after strikes around Baghdad airport in Iraq. Security officials say a former US base nearby, which still supports Washington's operations, was targeted by drones and rockets. LBC can reveal the government will introduce restrictions on people with loose connections to the UK being allowed to claim part of the state pension. It's going to drastically raise the amounts they have to pay into the system to see a return. More now from LBC's political editor, Natasha Clark.
People can pay voluntary national insurance contributions from abroad, but they've previously only had to contribute as little as £182 per year. That amount will rise to £900 per year, and people will only be able to contribute if they've lived in the UK for at least a decade. Torsten Bell, the pensions minister, told us that the system needs to be fair and that he is stopping people with little links from the UK from being able to build up entitlement to the state pension on the cheap.
And police in Northern Ireland are investigating the deaths of 13 lambs in County Down. It's thought their necks were broken deliberately at a farm in Ross Trevor sometime between Friday night and Saturday morning. LBC weather, blustery showers overnight, particularly in northwestern areas. They could be heavy at times, and those showers could turn wintry across northern hills. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Let's talk about social media. There's a court case going on in California at the moment, and the lawyer prosecuting this landmark social media harm case against Meta and Google said that the defendants were guilty of addicting the brains of children. He said features such as autoplay videos, infinite scrolling, and constantly chirruping alerts woven into the fabric of online platforms were central to addicting the brains of children. The companies involved say they are just giving the consumers more of what they want. Fevzi Turkalp is editor of Gadget Detective, and he joins us on the phone now. Hello, Fevzi.
Hi.
So what do you think? Are the social media companies engaging in addicting the brains of children?
I think so. Briefly. These cases are quite interesting because normally social media companies are immune to allegations of this sort because there's something called Section 230 immunity, which makes sure that they're not held responsible for the content that they carry because it's third-party content. So, but these cases focus on harmful design, not just harmful content. And, you know, you've touched on some of the things that they're accused of. I mean, we can see, you know, this infinite scrolling, this doom scrolling, the auto-playing of the next video, the push notifications to drag people back into the app, highly personalized recommendation system, so the algorithm observing what holds an individual's attention, then serving more of it, and social reward mechanics, you know, likes and so forth. This is the equivalent of training animals with doggy treats. You know, we get likes and we get a little buzz out of it. These things, you know, I think there's a strong argument to say that they are addictive, and combined with the fact that they're not doing enough to keep 13-year-olds and younger off their platforms, and they're not issuing proper warnings mean that there is a case to answer. Some of them have been going on for 4 years now.
Really?
And they've gone through, the social media platforms have tried to have them struck out at various points. And the fact that they've survived to this point, and that there are many of these cases, and these are bellwether cases, so if they win, there will be thousands more of these cases. I find it hard to believe that the social media companies will come out of this unscathed.
And so the basis is that, as you said before, that previously they've been able to knock this stuff out because they say, like a paper manufacturer would say, well, I can't possibly be responsible for what people write on my paper. But in this case, it's a paper manufacturer is accused of making paper laced with heroin, which does addict the person who is using that product.
Exactly right. So Section 230 stops internet platforms being treated as the publisher. They are more like BT would argue that it's not responsible for the conversations that take place on its phone lines. Yeah. The reality is it's somewhere between the two, that they're not as passive as a telephone line, but they don't have the same control necessarily as a publisher who commissions articles.
But it's not about it's not about the content. It's about how they are delivering that content specifically, isn't it? All of this autoplay videos, the infinite scrolling, the constantly chirping alerts, that kind of thing is what creates the addiction, is the charge.
Yeah, absolutely. And also there's other things that are deemed to be harmful, things like filters and appearance tools that they don't keep people scrolling and so forth, but they worsen body image pressure. You know, people are using these tools to try and make themselves look better. Hmm. So it is deemed to be a harmful platform by design, not just by content. That's the allegation. And B, that they're not warning against it, and C, that they're not doing enough to keep vulnerable people, particularly younger people, off it. I mean, I would say you could argue that these platforms are harmful to everybody, perhaps particularly to younger people, but not only to them.
Yes, it sounds very much like the tobacco industry accusations. And like the tobacco industry, a whistleblower in one of these companies has said that, well, you know, we knew this, that we did it in research. The company itself did the research and found that their products were creating addictions in their users. The exact same thing happened with the tobacco industry. They conducted research, found their product harmed their consumers, hid the research, and then carried on selling it.
Yeah, there are clear parallels, and that a lot of that is being aired out in court as well. But it is quite remarkable that, you know, there are these documents out there of meetings where, things are found to be harmful and then continued with. I think it's quite hard to defend against. I mean, it's interesting that, some of the companies accused actually settled. ByteDance, for example, that has TikTok settled. Meta and Google did not. But there are going to be so many of these cases, I just don't think they're going to go away. If the social media platforms won a knockout blow, then it might deter others. But there are so many different groups. I mean, this first case is brought by a young woman who's known as KGM, sometimes Kayla. We don't know her actual identity. She's claiming personal harm, but some of these cases are being brought by school districts and many other sorts of bodies. Even states are bringing cases. So it's just not conceivable that they'll all fail. And the effect of that, I guess, will be, if there is some progress made with these allegations, that somehow the products will start to be changed. Maybe not enough. And maybe they'll find other ways of achieving their goals without falling foul of the current law. But I think the other thing I'd say about this is that how can I explain? This has been going on for 4 years. These platforms develop almost weekly in terms of what they do and the tricks that they pull. And so the law is always going to be in catch-up mode over this.
Yes, it is a difficult thing, though, isn't it? Because what is the difference between creating addictions and giving people more of what they want?
It's to do with harm. If a product is harmful and the purveyor of that product is seeking to maximise the ingestion of that product. Imagine if it were a drug. You know, drugs are maybe deemed to be safe up to a certain limit, available over the counter, but deadly over a certain limit. And you couldn't, if a drug company were encouraging people to take too many of a, you know, otherwise safe drug, you know, they would get into a lot of trouble. And these things, you know, because they're technology and because they're fast moving and because there's not the sort of regulatory and safety testing processes for social media that there are for things like drugs, it's always going to be difficult. But it's not good enough to say we're giving people what they want. I mean, a heroin dealer could say that.
But then so could somebody who sells water. You know, water is a very good thing, unless you drink 32 litres of it and then you die.
Right, but then if the water companies were running subliminal adverts encouraging you to drink more and more and more water, more than is good for you, and then you were harmed by that, there would be a case to answer.
Right, but it's not addictive like heroin. It's addictive in its nature of giving you positive feedback and an endlessly entertaining, you know, all that stuff, people dancing and cats riding around on robot vacuum cleaners and all that sort of stuff. So it's not like heroin, is it? So you could say, I'm sure that the companies are saying, well, you know, if it's becoming too much, just snap out of it, put your phone down, read a book.
Yeah, except that, you know, that these companies employ psychologists to make these products compulsive. You know, they're not compulsive,
right,
by accident.
Right, so that's the nature of it, that they're deliberately sort of enfeebling their audience so that that making it more impossible for them to actually disengage.
Yes, and that's the burden of proof now on the plaintiffs, that they need to show either that it's deliberate or that it's negligent.
Right. I mean, they talked about the infinite scroll. I talk about this on my other shows quite a lot. What do you think the effects are of that so-called infinite scroll, the never-ending nature of social media?
So there's no natural stopping points. That's what it means by infinite scroll. You can just keep scrolling and scrolling. There's no point where you say, okay, that's the end of a chapter of a book, or, you know, the end of an episode of a TV show. There's no end to it. And I know when I've fallen down sort of rabbit holes and so forth, that at the end of it, I feel quite unwell. I feel sullied, a little bit dirty, that I wasted an hour and a half doing that. Doesn't make me feel good.
Mm.
You know, so I, and it's a design. It's not something that was just there by accident.
Yes.
It was designed into the product. And if you look, the ultimate problem with all of this is the business model. How do they make their money? And their business model relies upon having eyes on the screen for as long as possible, to drive engagement by triggering certain emotions. And although you say it's not the same as a drug, there are aspects of it that are the same as a drug, because there are chemical changes that go on in our brains, you know, that are triggered by these events. And, you know, it's not passive. It's not dissimilar to a drug. And I personally feel that, you know, we need to get into the weeds with the algorithms, because that's the key to all of this.
Well,
to
do
stopping
you think,
it. But,
yeah, sorry to interrupt, but do you think that we're engaged in a sort of a worldwide science experiment on children's brains, rewiring them to demand instant dopamine hits and an endless supply of ever-changing brief entertainment?
Yeah, well, I mean, the commercial organizations, the people who run these platforms, are definitely finding new ways to keep us hooked to their platforms. And I use the term hooked colloquially. It doesn't have to be a medical addiction to be harmful. I mean, something can be compulsive and harmful. It's usually a matter of degree. And I do think that the difficulty with all of this is the time lag, the speed with which it changes, the technology changes. So even if you do a 5-year study into whether a particular design feature is harmful or whether a platform is harmful, it's largely, the findings are largely irrelevant by then, because the technology will have moved on hugely.
Yeah.
You know, you're dealing with 3D holographic spaces and just things that weren't, and look at, I mean, AI systems, large language models, things like ChatGPT and Perplexity and all the others. Again, you know, there are potential harms in those things. There are very good aspects of them, but there are potential harms. But again, it would take years to work out what those are, and this is an industry where the technology, you know, I probably cover three major announcements a week, just in AI, and the ability to research these things in detail is hard. So I think we also have to apply a precautionary approach and just say everything in moderation, and things that are designed not to be used in moderation are probably problematic.
Well, you know, some countries have made a sort of a half-hearted attempt to fight back, haven't they? Australia banned social media for under 16s. Here in the UK, our government's just launched a consultation rather than actually doing anything. Well, and what do you make of how countries are reacting to this?
I think it's, you know, there's a case to be made for banning social media for under 16s, but it shouldn't be the only tool in the toolbox. So, you know, like with say cigarettes, we ban minors from buying cigarettes, but we also try to regulate cigarettes to make sure that they're not, you know, not more harmful than they need to be. There is a multi-pronged approach, and in the same way, you can ban for under 16-year-olds to social media, but that's not enough. You need to look at the product and say, why is it that we're having to ban it for under 16s? Are there harms being caused to over 16s? And adults are not immune to these design choices. So that should be done as well. So I think, yeah, an under 16 ban, you know, there's pros and cons to it, but I think it's defendable. But I just don't think it's enough on its own.
Do you think that the companies themselves are actually now too big to fight? If you look at the list of the top 10 richest people in the world, it's absolutely stuffed with these psycho tech bros who have to their name hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars each and seem obsessed with making nothing but more and more and more. And you said that TikTok settled, as did another company, but they're still there. They're still doing the exact same thing. It's just pocket change to them, fines.
Well, and that's the point of settling, so you don't get case law against you. But I do think this is there's too much power vested in too few hands, and that these organizations are so powerful, and they have the ear of the presidency of the United States. If you look at AI companies, although Anthropic is currently, you know, suing the US government, and that's an exception. I just think that you've got, for example, the American administration trying to push the rest of the world not to regulate AI development. And this is an extremely difficult and dangerous position for them to take, but they're doing it because they want to be ahead in the competition to achieve AI dominance, particularly against the Chinese and others. And I just think it is dangerous, because when the companies are that large, and they have the ability to do political favours and get candidates elected and all the rest of it, that it does form a somewhat unholy and dangerous alliance, I think.
Do you think that social media is a passing fad, that in the not-too-distant future we'll be looking back and be quite embarrassed at how much time we wasted on this stuff?
I think the ways in which we will be manipulated and waste our time will change. So, you know, probably won't call it social media in the future. But I think that our relationship with technology is locked in and on a quite a harmful course, because these things get problematic when they are indulged in to the extent that they start to cause other aspects of our lives to fall apart, that we don't attend for meals, we become isolated, we become depressed, we have, you know, body image problems and so forth. I think those problems, I think regulators have got their work cut out for them. I don't want to say they're on a hiding to nothing, but I don't see any signs that Ofcom is up to the job in this regard, to be fair with you. So I think that the detail of what we engage in will change, but the dangerous effects of these products owned by billionaires, I fear, will continue.
And do you make a differentiation between the kind of sites that we've been talking about and news websites? Because to my eyes, they're the same. It's a physical paper has an end. You know where it stops. News websites go on forever, and they engage their readers by making them usually either angry or afraid.
Yeah, or better informed. I mean, it's also dangerous, of course. Yeah. I wouldn't classify a news website in the same way, because I don't think there's the same degree of harm, except where the news website is a quasi-news website, and again, it's designed. But the problem is that the traditional model was, you know, no one can make a good news newspaper or a good news television station because people aren't engaged by good news. Yeah. And it is a development of that idea that there are certain emotions that if we engender them, we engender fear, or anger in people, then that will keep us more engaged than if we engender other emotions in people.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, these social media platforms are doing that. Add into the mix, even if the social media platforms are completely innocent, add into the mix AI slop. This AI content that keeps misinforming us and addicting us and being harder and harder to spot. So now there's all this AI stuff about, you know, a dozen American soldiers captured in Iran, and all these very convincing videos of this. And we need an education program similar to what they have in Finland. So Finland has been the subject of disinformation campaigns, initially from the Soviet Union and then by Russia for decades. And they treat disinformation as an illness that needs to be vaccinated against. And the vaccine for them is education. And they teach people the basic skills that journalists are taught. You know, check the source of your story, try and confirm it from more than one source, look, you know, do some research and find out whether that story is likely to be true or not. It doesn't teach people what to believe, but in schools they teach them critical thinking skills to help them not be immune to it, but at least to mitigate the effects of these sorts of contents, which have just got worse with AI, unfortunately. And they're getting more convincing. I can spot most AI videos now. I probably won't be able to in 6 months' time, certainly not by the end of the year.
Mm. Let's be more Finnish. Fevzi,
yeah.
great place for talking to you.
Let's not auto-scroll, let's finish.
Right? Yes. Thanks so much for that. That's Fevzi Turkalp, editor for Gadget Detective. So has any of this resonated with you? Do you find that you have become addicted to social media, addicted to scrolling, the constant hit that you get from a new exciting video of whatever it might be over and over and over and over again? Because I see a lot of young people seem to be so obsessed with it, so utterly entranced, they don't even look up when they're crossing the road. 0345 6060 973, LBC.
This is LBC.
With Betfred, when you bet £10, you get £50 in free bets. So, want to back your new striker to score the first goal? Your midfield maestro to get the assist? Want to say there'll be a header? Want to see their striker caught offside? He was born offside. Want to predict the final score? Or both teams to score? Want to get involved for 90 minutes? Want to nick it in extra time? Want to bet £10 and get £50 in free bets? Want to bet? Betfred. New online customers only. £5, £10 free bets. T's and C's and exclusions apply. 18+. Gambleaware.org.
The famous five were boarding the train, ready for their next great Western adventure.
Who knew Wales and the Southwest had so many myths and legends? Said Anne. Such amazing stories. King Arthur's Camelot, the giants of Avon Gorge, the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Oh, I do like listening to a good tale, said George excitedly. You're good at telling tales too, teased Dick.
Great Western Railway. Legendary adventures start here.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Well, we're talking about this interesting case in California at the moment, and a lawyer prosecuting both Meta and Google, and Meta are their Facebook, aren't they? And I think Google have got YouTube. You would imagine that the other companies, the to my eyes, the more addictive companies, are they're probably on the edge of their seats, wondering where this is going to go, because their very future depends on it, I would imagine, depends on the outcome of this trial. And the defendants are guilty of addicting the brains of children, is the claim. And internal documents surfaced in the trial showed that Meta employees were worried about signs of rising, what they called, reward tolerance among users. One email conversation in 2020 showed one person referring to Instagram saying, Instagram is a drug. I mean, all social media were basically pushers, said one emailer, which is the kind of thing that you don't want to put on a work email, particularly if it's possible that you might be the subject of a lawsuit at some future moment. Sonia Livingston, a professor of social psychology at the London School of Economics, said, when you watch young people scroll through their feed, they flip really, really fast. They make split-second decisions to swipe, 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 watch, swipe, swipe, watch. There is always a feeling that the next thing could be good, and it's only going to be another second or two. That's the it of it, isn't it? And to my eyes, young people particularly do seem to be so addicted that they just cannot put the phone down. It's as though their brain starts screaming at them the moment they stop looking at it. Richmond. Hello, Angela.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm listening to this debate, and it occurred to me that what we need to do is teach people to teach the algorithm. So, if you are doom scrolling on you have to understand that if you stop and breathe for a minute and read the article or do whatever, then it is noticed. And to resist it, you have to not notice it anymore. Once you have found out the information that you want to find out, that's it. You have to leave it alone.
Hmm.
Otherwise, it will keep throwing things at you. And we have to teach the algorithm not to send us that. If we keep on rejecting the stuff that is not good and that we don't want, we don't like, and I mean, I don't even bother with likes. I mean, why? What is that all about? I don't get it. I really don't get it.
I think that's sharing the reward with other people, encouraging them to share that reward with you. You like their post and they'll like yours.
Lovely. So they like your post. Well, that makes me just feel, lovely and warm and pays my heating bill.
Right, it doesn't do that, but it does make people feel lovely and warm. And I think right. Well, you've just got to stop, and that might screw up the algorithm. I've just taken myself off X. It was the only social media site that I ever bothered with. Started when it was Twitter, when it used to be a place of pleasantness and amusement, and now it's the absolute opposite of that. And I don't miss it at all. Thanks for that, Angela. And I think that you won't miss it either. Turn off the screen and walk away from your phone. Now, talking of screens, the 98th Academy Awards are underway in Hollywood. We're going to catch up with the big news of the night so far. Who is going to pick up the Best Picture Award, I wonder? It's just past 12:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The University of Kent has confirmed a student is one of the two people who've died following a meningitis outbreak in Canterbury. The UK Health Security Agency is investigating after being alerted to 13 cases. The French president has told his Iranian counterpart to stop Tehran's attacks against countries in the Gulf region. Emmanuel Macron has been talking to Masoud Pezeshkian. And LBC can reveal the government will introduce restrictions on people with loose connections to the UK being allowed to claim part of the state pension. It's going to drastically raise the amounts they have to pay into the system to get a return. LBC weather, blustery showers overnight, particularly in the northwest. They could be heavy at times and they could turn wintry in northern areas. We'll see a low of around about 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
At AJ Bell, we believe investing is for everyone. And when we say everyone, we mean your dad, Dan, Danielle, Dean, Dave, Dell, Dell's delivery driver Denise, Denise's dentist Dinesh, and Devon's strongest man, Donathan. Donathan? Donathan, that can't be right. Donathan? Well, whatever your name is, if you're a real person, investing is for you too. AJ Bell, feel good investing. The value of your investments can go up or down.
This is 40-year-old Kathy, mother of two and self-confessed telly addict.
Ready? Oh, look at you, that's brilliant. Well done.
This is also Kathy, working as part of a team to keep things calm at her local prison.
Listen, speak to me.
And helping someone's son write his first letter home in 8 months.
Well done, you should be really proud.
Thank you, miss.
An extraordinary job, done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
The big screens, big night is upon us. It's underway. The Oscars ceremony is continuing in Los Angeles. The film critic and broadcaster James Cameron Wilson is on the line now to tell us all about it. Hello, James.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. So the ceremony is, what, about half an hour in, something like that?
It's more like a third of the way through.
Oh, really?
And it is so predictable, I'm afraid.
Oh, dear.
They're really playing safe. I can't believe that Amy Madigan got the Oscar for such an over-the-top performance for a horror film called Weapons. This is a vintage year for horror. Frankenstein already has two Oscars. Sinners has got a record 16 Oscar nominations, and that's a vampire movie. And they're going for all the predictable ones. Sean Penn was a shoo-in for Best Supporting Actor for one battle after another. This is his third Oscar. He hasn't turned up at any award ceremony, and he's now got number three after winning it for Mystic River and for Milk, and now one battle after another. He is terrific. I did vote for him for the London Film Critics Circle Awards. But I'm just, be nice to see something, a surprise.
I'm surprised that a serial no-show is rewarded by the Oscar judges. I mean, Woody Allen famously never used to show. He always used to have an appointment to play with a jazz band. But what's Sean Penn's excuse?
Well, this is very true. I just think he doesn't really care. He's got two Oscars. Why should he bother to put on a suit
right. And
go out when he can watch from home and enjoy it? I mean, he is terrific, to be fair. And as I said, I did vote for him. But it would be nice for somebody like Delroy Lindo, who is so loved by the Academy, to win something. Or Wunmi Mosaku, also for Sinners. And to see, well, they're both black actors, and it's Oscar so white all over again.
I can remember the Oscar ceremony when I was a kid being completely confusing because those days we were 6 months behind America in their release schedule.
Yes, that's
so,
right, yes.
So we hadn't seen any of the films that they were talking about. And now
they open simultaneously.
Yes, and now they do open simultaneously, but people don't go and see them anymore because people are sitting at home scrolling through Netflix to see what they can find.
Well, it's very interesting because Ted Serrano, the head of Netflix, was there. And Conan O'Brien, who is the host, was asking him from the stage, what's it feel like to be in a theatre? Which was a nice joke. And Netflix is doing really well because it's already won for Frankenstein. Two Oscars for Frankenstein. And Best Animation went to K-pop Demon Hunters, which was, again, the favourite. I mean, it's... There's so many awards ceremonies now, and the first one that I went to was the London Film Critics Circle, but there's the Actors Award, which used to be the SAG, there's the Golden Globe, there's the BAFTAs. You can now predict what Oscars will go to whom.
Who actually is the are the people that vote for these awards. Who are they?
They are members of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. You have to be nominated to become a member. There are about 10,000 of them. A few years ago, the average age of the American Oscar voter was 61. Wow. But they've reduced that, and they've made it more inclusive by trying to invite more non-white members into the Academy. So you've got 10,000 people, and you're trying to think, well, how can you anticipate what 10,000 different people are going to vote for? And journalists often say, well, Oscar this and Oscar that. Well, no, it's not one person. It's not even a chair. It's not a body. It's 10,000 people who work in the business. They're really busy. They're making different films. And they only have time to see a set number of titles. So when one film starts to get traction and get some buzz, those are the films that they're going to watch. So a masterpiece that nobody, that hasn't really caught fire, hasn't caught the imagination, is not going to be nominated, which is why a film like Sinners, good as it is, would get 16 nominations.
So also, the studios engage in massive publicity campaigns, don't they, to try to push their film into the onto the TVs of the people that you've just described. So, where was the big money being spent this year?
On one battle after another. Netflix has always put a lot of money into their titles. Sinners and Hamlet, which was executive produced, let us not forget, by Steven Spielberg. But I think the one really interesting thing so far tonight was to actually see the best live action short come up with a tie, which is the third time ever in the 98-year history of Oscar, which was quite surprising. That's the only surprise we've actually seen.
So do they give out two Oscars?
They cut one in half. The actor presenting it announced one, and he said, I want you to come up and accept it, and then when you go back to your seat, I'm going to announce the winner of the Thai film for Best Live Action Short.
Right.
And as I say, that's never happened before. I remember, I was at school, when Barbara Streisand tied with Katharine Hepburn back in 1969 for two 1968 films.
Timothy Chalamet was being set up as a shoo-in for the best actor, and then he said something that didn't go down very well. What's been the fallout from that?
I think Timothy Chalamet is going to be around for a very long time. He is a very fine actor, and I think people will think that in the future he will get an Oscar. Later, rather like Leonardo DiCaprio had to get a number of nominations before he won for The Revenant. But Timothée Chalamet made a pejorative comment about ballet and opera and these old school art forms, which got a lot of shtick because there are a lot of opera lovers in Hollywood, and he's no longer the favorite to win. But I think it was very funny because they have the songs on the stage, and they did a song from Sinners, and they threw in a ballet dancer, which I think was a direct snub of Timothée Chalamet. But I think now it's not going to be Leonardo DiCaprio for one battle after another. Good as he is, he's already got an Oscar. I think it's going to go to Michael B. Jordan for playing two characters in Sinners.
Right, just to, in case people don't know, Timothée Chalamet said, I don't want to be working in ballet or opera and things where it's like, keep this thing alive, even though no one cares about this anymore.
And, ow.
Well, yes, ow, but most people really don't care about ballet and opera. I mean, they're niche areas of showbiz that need huge grants to keep them going. But it is odd that he is in a... He's tipped for an Oscar in a film about table tennis, which no one cares about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's quite a lot of ballet, actually, in his family, if I read correctly. I heard about that. So, yeah, but I think a lot of the suits in Hollywood are really, really behind ballet and opera. So that was a bad move,
right,
Timmy.
And the death of the Oscar ceremony has been somewhat overstated, hasn't it? Because last year, there was, in America, this is 19.5 million people, which was up from 18.8 the previous year. So even though the box office numbers seem to be going down and have done, you know, particularly since COVID, they haven't completely recovered, interest in this ceremony seems to be quite solid.
Well, Conan O'Brien, in his opening speech, said that over 1 billion people are watching the Oscars around the world. That is huge. Those are huge figures. And he also mentioned the enormous number of countries who are actually nominated in one category or another this year. So they're becoming more global and more inclusive, not just with non-Caucasian nominees, but different countries as well.
I mean, you've used the words like inclusive. I mean, that some people will cause their brains to start ringing at the mention of that. Do you think that some people are being given awards just on the basis of the organisation trying to be inclusive?
Well, there are more people in the Academy who are members of the American Academy of Arts and Science who are non-Caucasian. So hopefully they will vote for their own, but we haven't seen that so far. I hope Michael B. Jordan, and when it comes down to it, Sinners will turn that around. Michael B. Jordan is a terrific actor, and I think Timothy Chalamet, his time will come. I think the only, because they're going for the shoo-ins, it's so far, anyway, I think we can say that Jessie Buckley will be the first Irish actress ever to win an Oscar for Best Actress. And of course, I think it should be pointed out when we're talking of inclusivity that only one black actress, only one black woman has ever won the Oscar for Best Actress. And I thought, well, this year it has to happen after 98 years. But of course, none of them were nominated. So Jessie Buckley, I think, has it in the bag. She's previously been nominated for The Lost Daughter, which was directed by Maggie Gyllenhaal, who's also directed Jessie Buckley in the new film called The Bride, and it's such an extraordinary performance. You could barely realise it's the same actress playing these two different roles. She is quite extraordinary.
And just finally, has anything this year happened that is as memorable as Will Smith slapping Chris Rock?
Apart from the tie for best live action short, and that's a very small category in the whole scheme of things, no, it's a fairly vanilla show so far, I'm afraid.
Good to talk to you, James. Thanks so much for that. That's James Cameron Wilson, the film critic and broadcaster on the Oscars ceremony, which is underway at this moment. Going to take a break, and then we will be talking to our US correspondent for the latest from there. This is LBC.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
A bill's passed to stop women having illegal abortions being prosecuted, but should the law on terminations be changed? And is it time for Britain to plough money into our own defence forces and stop relying on America for protection?
Richard Spur at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Wealth. It's not about the money. It's the freedom you always said you'd like. And investing in life's greatest asset. You. It's choosing how you spend your time and who you spend it with. It's about everything made possible. Because wealth isn't about the money. It's the means to more. Join over 1 million people saving and investing with Moneybox today. Capital at risk, ISA and tax rules apply.
This time last year, Hassan was working in sales and spent his evenings gaming. Now, he's working as a prison officer.
You know what's come out, it's not worth it. Let's just go in there.
He's tackled cell fires, got through to some of the most challenging prisoners, and helped support their rehabilitation. He's done things he once thought he was never capable of, but he still loves his gaming. An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
Go from someday to sunny days in Greece.
with package holidays from £329 per person. So stop dreaming of souvlaki. Stop scrolling crystal clear beaches. Search EasyJet Holidays and get your holiday in Greece sorted today. Get out there. Selected dates April to September. Limited availability. Atoll protected. T's and C's apply.
This was made with human intelligence.
And artificial intelligence.
Just like Intuit QuickBooks business management software. If you're a sole trader earning over 50K from April 2026, making tax digital means...
you have to file your taxes online.
But new QuickBooks AI has...
automated tools to help make compliance easier.
I was going to say that. I'll do it with Intuit QuickBooks.
It's drawn.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
John Christopher Buer is the White House correspondent for Real Political News, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, John.
Great being with you, Nick, on this British Mum's Day, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. It's also Oscars Day. Are you glued to the screen?
Well, I'm glued to Billy Crystal, and I'm glued to Rob Reiner, but I'm more glued to you because I owe you my 100% attention, and you got it. But I got it on mute.
You got it on mute,
My wife's taking it in while she coaches me.
Well, what do you think about the best director and most extraordinary performance by a leading man, the Secretary of Awesome War, Pete Hegseth? How is his performance so far in this Iranian conflagration striking you?
Well, I used to be on the soap operas. I don't know if you don't have them quite as we do in this country, but there was one called The Young and the Restless, or The Bold and the Beautiful, or something, and Pete Hegseth looks like he's so angry, he's so annoyed with the world because he was rejected from The Young and the Restless, and that's who he is, the soap opera boy, and that's how he is the Secretary of Defense, changing the name of the organization to Secretary of War, and he wears the bloody American flag as a pocket linen, and I think that is disgraceful.
He was berating the press for not being approving enough of the Trump regime's war in Iran. Are the press just going to roll over and take that, or are they going to acquire a spine?
I think my colleagues in the briefing room and myself have acquired many spines during this administration. And I think we have to stand up and fight for what's right. We have a First Amendment in this country, and it is we have to make the country aware that he had no plan for the war at all, and they need to write a new script because it's not working. And the latest is, Nick, you need to know, if you don't, the Trump administration and Israel are saying today they will continue, this war will continue weeks and further damage the world economy, and now the oil has gone up to $100 a barrel, and what is he going to do in the Strait of Hormuz? Blow it up? I mean, he's really lost his way, and he's looking bad, and we will answer it because we don't accept this in this country. As President Kennedy said, the First Amendment is probably our most important amendment in this Constitution.
Freedom of speech, but that is under attack by the very man who oversees the television and the radio channels, isn't it? The Federal Communications Commission chair, Brendan Carr, Trump's man, has said that TV and, I don't know whether he mentioned radio, but he said TV stations, if they don't, straighten up and fly right and start slathering praise over the regime, then we're going to take their licenses away.
How about that, huh? How about that? That's our job, to ask the most important questions, especially when there's a war going on. And that's who we are as a nation. I know Great Britain is that way as a nation. We must have freedom of the airways, must have freedom of press. And you cannot do that, and it will not stand. And eventually, this guy, Trump, is going to lose. And then we'll see what happens then.
But they're not losing, though, are they? The major media companies are bowing down before Trump. They're giving him exactly what they want.
Well, I don't think they are really doing that. I think if you look at the few stations that are Trump's disciples, basically, sycophants, that's true. But there are others who are not, and there are people who and there are newspapers that are not, and we do have press there who is not. And I think that we do not bow down to this dictator, in fact, and we will rise up, and it's going to happen. And we have another day in the streets in March, and we're going to be marching and alerting people to fight against this tyranny, and that's what it is. He had no strategy and no plan ever with this invasion of Iran and the American people. We now have 13 service people dead. The lines are just going out of the supermarkets because people can't afford even to buy food. And Trump still has his headline supporters, his hardline supporters, I should say, the MAGA people. But the people who this Gulf War is affecting, and the price of oil and food is affecting, are those who are turning against him, bold face and on dime.
But is that really happening, though? I mean, I know that the Democrats are almost all against the war and Trump's handling of it, but the Republicans seem to be similarly. It's like a mirror image. It's as though America is two countries now.
Well, there's certainly part of this country that will always be for Trump, okay? But the polls show that I think this 40%, I believe, 39% are against Trump, and they are adamantly against him. And you have his MAGA supporters who are for him. But, you know, those people who are in a war, who are fighting, and who are affected by these job cuts that will be happening, will in fact come around. They'll change. And I don't think it's that Trump's never addressed the country and explained why he's doing this. And I think the American people, you know, in a day or two, and I think even now, are realizing that. And I think his luck will run out.
Why do you think he's doing this?
Well, first of all, there's many reasons why he's doing this. The first one is that many people believe that this is one of the distractions that he wanted to focus the American people and get them off the Epstein files, which were about to reveal some very unsavory items, including some people you may know. And the Epstein files, along with this topic, has somewhat disappeared from the news. And others think that this is a phase one of Trump's trying to take over our midterm elections, and in the process, since it seems clear, he is likely to lose the House and maybe even the Senate. And some people even believe that he will put in some kind of a martial law effect and stop people from voting. Now, he's tried to affect the elections by having eliminating mail-in ballots, by putting the focus on other issues. And, you know, in the middle, he's supposed to be rebuilding this country, you know, he says. But what he's rebuilding is White House. He's rebuilding his takeover of Venezuela, threatening to take over Greenland, and now possibly Cuba. I mean, he's really gone off the deep end, I must say. And we're about 7 months away from the midterms, and his polls are not great. And the war in Iran has not changed support among the diehard supporters. That's true. But this week he's trying to change the way Americans vote.
It's
and rig the election system for himself.
Yes. It is interesting, isn't it, that he bombed people off the coast of Venezuela, then invaded Venezuela, kidnapped
right.
its leader, frog-marched him
yes.
out of the country in a blindfold, and no one's
right.
talking about it anymore.
Well, I don't...
It's like it never happened.
Well, there's plenty of people talking about it. I know we've got the news media here who's talking about it, and I think I'm certainly talking about it, and I've got the opportunity to talk about it on LBC, and there's plenty of other people who I know have been talking about what he's doing to corrupt this country, and people don't really think that he's for real. They don't understand. Next week, the Democrats will try to regain the presidency. They probably will not succeed. Excuse me, they will probably try to rein in this president. They're probably not, but Trump broke all his promises and to pieces, and it's up to us to restart it again and to focus on what's important for this country. And I will say something about the Oscars. It's probably a big relief for most people, because I have said something, Nick, the environment here, and you know I work at the White House as a correspondent for Real Political News, it's not a pleasure. It used to be a joy to go there. Even in Trump's first term, I enjoyed going there. It was historical. He's changing it. He's building this absurd ballroom, which is so gauche and so out of touch. He's changing the name of the Kennedy Center to the Trump Kennedy Center. And I thought Conan O'Brien, I don't know if you were watching the Oscars, but Conan O'Brien said a very opening, funny opening line. He says, in reference to what Trump's changing it, he says, I'm going to change the name of theater where we are now into the small, and I won't use the word, he referred to male organ.
Yeah.
The small organ theater. So Trump can put his name in, on the small organ theater. The Donald Trump small organ theater. So I thought it was really a great beginning. And you'll see more of that in the press tomorrow.
Well, what we're seeing in the press, like social media, you've probably seen this yourself, is the White House putting out videos in the manner of a rock video to people being blown up to the music of AC/DC. How's that going down?
It's just disgraceful. It's on all the time. People are talking about it all the time. He's taking these explosions and killing people in boats and sort of the Strait of Hormuz and the island, the Koga Island, I believe it's called, and he's killing people, and he's showing them as video games. And these are people whose parents, whose mother and father and wives and sisters know that our American soldiers and sailors and airmen are at risk, at great risk, and he's making a joke of it. To me, that is probably the most diabolical and disgustingly atrocious thing that any president, and I grew up from Truman to JFK and Eisenhower, my God, we would just be livid. And Clinton and Obama, and Richard Nixon is looking damn good right now.
Yeah, well, I can't remember which comic said it, but Nixon said, I am not a crook. And Donald Trump said, yeah, I'm a crook, so what?
Right. I grew up with Tricky Dicky, okay? And I watched the Kennedy-Nixon debates, and I thought, you know, Nixon is, he never hated this country. Richard Nixon went off. He did the whole Watergate thing to keep in his power, to keep in place. But then he resigned. Then we had to resign, so he resigned. And I give Nixon a lot more credit than certainly Trump. And people do not think Trump is focused on the right priorities. He promises he would lower prices, never did. He promises no forever wars. He's already in money. He says this could last. You know what he said, Nick? He said, I'll know when the war is going to end because I'll feel it in my bones.
My bones, yeah.
His bones, his broken bones. He's broken all the key promises, and we've got 7 months to go before the primary, the next elections.
Yeah. Fingers crossed
these
they actually.
Midterms, and
yeah.
These are big. These are big deal.
Wow.
And we're seeing already there's elections happening now in states where Trump won. And the Democrats aren't.
Well,
and I'm not necessarily a Democrat, but I care about my country. I care about the First Amendment, and I always love talking to you.
Yeah, well, ditto, and I will be amazed if those elections actually took place. And I've been betting that they won't for quite a long time now. Good to talk to you, John. John Christopher Buer, White House correspondent for Real Political News. Now, if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or LBC app, where you can also stay up to date with the latest news and the videos. We've got opinions on there, a boatload. If you haven't got it, then it is free. Both of them are. Get them free from your app store now. Global Player app and the LBC app. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. At 4, Ian Payne. Right now, Richard Spur.
Good morning, Nick, and good morning to you. A bill's passed in the Commons to bring an end to women who have illegal abortions from being prosecuted, although the Lords could amend it. Many see the move as controversial. But do you believe UK laws on termination should be changed? But first, the Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, has called for the government to pay for a completely independent nuclear deterrent, as it can no longer rely on the US, acknowledging that it would cost our country billions. He said that Donald Trump has made his support for European security conditional on his day-to-day personal whims. So this morning, do you agree with the leader of the Liberal Democrats? Should Britain now plough money, despite the deficit in the public purse into our own defence forces and stop relying on US protection. 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. President Trump has criticised the UK again over its support for the US attacks against Iran. He's been telling a newspaper Britain might be considered Washington's closest ally, but it didn't want to come when asked. Donald Trump has also used his interview to warn NATO faces a very bad future if allies fail to step up. But the former US Lieutenant Colonel Daniel L. Davis has been telling LBC he thinks the Trump administration hasn't planned its operation against Iran.
We have plunged ourselves into something that has no observable off-ramp. For the first time in my living history, you have an opponent of the United States that said, hey, we're going to stand up to you no matter what it costs us, however many missiles you want to throw at us, how many troops, we're going to fight until you succumb to our terms. No one's ever done that to us, much less Donald Trump. And frankly, I don't see any easy off-ramps that he can take, period.
Foreign ministers from the EU are due to meet later on to discuss increasing a small naval mission in the Middle East, but they're not expected to make any decision on potential action concerning the Strait of Hormuz. It's been largely closed since the US and Israel began attacking Iran. The UK Health Security Agency says it's interviewing those affected by a meningitis outbreak in Canterbury, which has killed two people. It's been notified of 13 cases in total connected to the University of Kent. Antibiotics are also being arranged for those affected. The senior clinic